Full program with Richard C. Hoagland. Later on in the program, Joseph Farrell will join Richard C. as we talk about gravity, anti-gravity, free energy, space exploration. Of course, you know Richard C. Hoagland is the former Space Science Museum curator, worked for CBS News during the historic Apollo missions to the moon. He has written the best-selling book, Dark Mission, heads up the enterprisemission.com, and also is our science advisor. And Richard, you just heard our little happy birthday greeting to Ray Bradbury. Now we've got another one. Last week, your significant other, Robin Falkov, her birthday.
That's right.
Shall we? Hey, by the way, sometime tonight, I'm going to put you on the spot. Because when I was in Santa Maria at a special UFO conference last weekend, a partner of yours, whose name will go unmentioned, said that you were one of the greatest opera singers he has ever heard. Is this true, or was he pulling my leg?
Slightly pulling your leg. I actually was on Columbia Records with my brothers and sisters. We had a group called The Foregone Conclusion.
You're kidding me.
No, I was at the other end of CBS on the CBS label, simultaneous with advising Cronkite and the space unit and special events on going to the moon and all that. And I brought everyone together at a very famous Christmas party, which was the Christmas party celebrating the Apollo 8, you know, lunar around the moon, incredible extravaganza. And I sang a very special song to one of the producers that I hated.
You, Richard?
In this party.
That's funny. Hey, isn't it cool to be able to wish Ray Bradbury a happy 88th?
Oh, that is so cool. And yeah, of course he's not 88, he's 8.
He's 8.
You know, the thing that keeps all of us young is that we're too dumb to grow up. We actually think the world can be, you know, maneuvered into our visions, our dreams, our projections, the way it should be. And Ray is at the top of that list.
Absolutely.
And obviously, you know, when I was growing up, I read him vociferously. And in Monuments, I give an appropriate homage to, you know, the impact he had on me and the impressions that he left. So, you know, happy birthday, Ray. May you have another 88 at least.
And you know what keeps you young? You just keep working. Like he said, he's you know, doing his play, Fahrenheit 451. You just have to keep working, Richard. I think once you stop, that's when you get old.
Did you have, was it you or was it someone else? Maybe it was on Larry King. Somebody had a guest who had actually, you know, done a professional university-level study on this, and they find that 9-to-5ers who reach retirement age 65 and go home, a lot of them have heart attacks within 2 or 3 weeks and they die.
We had just a copy story on that a long time ago, not a guest.
Yeah, no, there's a serious study. In fact, there are many studies that show that if you're committed, you remain involved, you don't think of your job as a job but as a profession, a career, a life choice, something that is really part of you, you're a whole lot healthier and a whole lot better than if you come home every night and say, oh, I can't stand the damn thing. And then when you quit, you have nothing in your life, and you basically get bored and you die.
You wither away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
believe so. Obviously,
that
you and I are going to be around forever.
Gosh, I don't know about that, but we're going to give it our best, aren't we?
We will give it our best shot.
Hey, tonight, we've got just a few moments before the break, but give us highlights on some of these incredible things we're talking about tonight. You know, I spent the better part of today looking at your Wernher von Braun story on the enterprisemission.com, and I got to tell you, I was not aware of that story at all, which we'll talk about tonight.
I know. Well, you and I have done a million shows.
Yes,
well,
we
maybe
have.
Not a million.
Well, but close.
And Art and I did easily over a million.
2 million.
I will say, without fear or contradiction, that I think tonight's show that we're going to do, the next 4 hours and change, is probably the most important show I have ever done on Coast. And the reason I say that is because, apart from all the other evidence of unusual things and evidence that they've been hiding and artifacts and all that, the evidence we're going to talk about tonight and the implications of that evidence is absolutely incontrovertible. This is official NASA data. There's no question about the numbers, about the specifics. Anybody can check it. The implications of what it means have not been thought of by anybody, apparently, publicly until we figured this out. Later in the show, I'm going to read you some emails from some of the old-timers, the old rocket guys, who actually have worked on these programs, who worked on them with von Braun, who are basically confirming to me that we have figured it out, and they were sworn to secrecy never to talk about this. This is an extraordinary discovery. It's an extraordinary scandal because NASA, which picked up the cudgels from the Army and von Braun's early efforts to put a satellite into orbit, supposedly an open public civilian agency, kept this secret, knowing full well that they had to figure it out, otherwise we could never have gone to the moon, and we'll talk about the details of that. All the way up and down the line, people have simply turned their heads, ignored the implications of what's right in front of them, and the startling implications of what it could mean for everybody listening to my voice now, as well as every single human being on this planet. So I don't think it's hyperbole, and we'll obviously get emails at the end of the evening if people don't agree, but I don't think it's hyperbole for me to say that this may be one of the, if not the most important show that certainly you and I have ever done.
A couple, several weeks ago, I saw what definitely happened to be my first UFOs when I was at another conference in San Jose.
And you know that Robin had a similar sighting here?
Really?
She, based on your effusive, you know, discussion of the night vision and what you saw,
right,
went down to Tesla Tech and met up with George Gabori and Charles Osman and Bill Alec and a bunch of other guys on the roof, I guess, of the hotel. Apparently the roofs of hotels at these conferences are a great place to hang out.
Oh, yeah, they really are.
And somebody had brought a very high-tech, very expensive, like $4,000 pair of these.
That's third generation.
Third generation, yeah. Night vision amplification, you know, infrared, whatever. And they're standing on the roof looking, and they're seeing all kinds of weird, amazing things in the skies over Albuquerque, the land of enchantment, going back and forth in 90 degree and zigzags and all that. And then a huge boomerang flies over the hotel, trailing other objects around it, like they're escorting it, like what was reported during the whole Phoenix incident,
right,
back in 1997.
Only visible with those binoculars?
Night vision, which amplifies both starlight and the upward beams of the scattered light from the cities. But you can't see it with the naked eye. Now, we're here in really, really dark skies in the northeast part of the city. And what I'm going to try to do is to get someone in our audience, hint, hint, to loan me a beta version of these glasses, so we can actually not only see some things, but maybe record them with TV, because we've got
You can do that with the guns. And the beta version now would be a fourth generation that they're working on, which are supposed to be phenomenal.
And, of course, you know my thesis that they were not talking about UFOs. We're talking about the secret.
The secret. I was just going to ask you if you think what we've been looking at might be that, the secret program.
Did I send you a picture that one of my sources sent me a couple weeks ago?
You sent me a picture of me and Mike Berra at the San Jose thing.
No, this was a couple weeks ago.
No.
Okay, I was sent from Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines from 1972 by a master sergeant who was stationed on the base, the most astonishing, quote, color UFO picture you have ever seen, except it's not a UFO.
What is it?
It's clearly one of ours. It is a boomerang-shaped, obviously secret space program spacecraft hovering at a rakish angle over the nuclear weapons storage facility on Clark Air Force Base, and it comes to me through a very important and credible series of sources and connections.
If what we're going to talk about is accurate, and I know you believe it is.
Well, but no, you don't have to believe me. Just go Google on these orbits, and we'll explain
that. Okay, you can explain that to us.
Absolutely. And what I want you to do, by the way, is I want you to stop me every time I get into a term that you don't understand or you think someone out there doesn't understand.
All right.
Because it's really important that everybody get this. This is incredibly significant, and I don't want anybody to miss any of the cool parts of it.
Or just do what you've always done, like Michio Kaku does, speak in terms that I understand.
And you will tell
me. And we'll be okay then.
If I don't, yes.
But I think what this does, in the case you're building, is you're backing up why there's a secret program going on.
Well, yeah, because unlike the photographs that we talk about, there's no room for interpretation here. When you launch a satellite into space, according to 300-year-old Newton's laws and Kepler's, the dynamics are incredibly simple. I mean, they're so simple that even a high school kid can figure them out. That's how simple they're supposed to be. What happened with the first satellite that Wernher von Braun and his team of Operation Paperclip imported German Nazi engineers.
That was Explorer 1?
Explorer 1. Back in January 31, the late evening, 10:48 in the evening Eastern Time of January 31, 1958. Think back how old you were then.
I was 8.
Von Braun launched this satellite into orbit. And the story we're going to then unfold for the rest of this 4 hours is what happened when it reached space and did things that no self-respecting Newtonian law-abiding satellite should ever have done.
And they didn't expect it.
They didn't expect it. They knew that it was incredibly impossible. And there was a conspiracy, which I'm going to demonstrate, to cover it up from the highest to the lowest levels of this government and the other governments, including the Soviet Union, including the Europeans, the Japanese, the Chinese. Everybody is in on the secret, except the ordinary, common, everyday guy here in the U.S. who paid for those missions and all the subsequent missions. And we're going to describe in detail what happened that night, what von Braun did following what happened that night, which lets us know that he knew it was incredibly impossible.
And we're going to do that in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie here with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, I guess for us to begin, we must start at the beginning as Operation Paperclip, these brains of Germany, so many of them Nazis, came over here with their knowledge. Go ahead.
Well, they were all Nazis. You know, I mean, there was nobody in Germany who couldn't be, because certainly if you had a position of responsibility, if you were involved heavily in engineering and science, helping Hitler win the war, helping the Reich, you know, perpetuate its thousand-year mythology, they didn't, for security reasons, let anybody in those positions do any of this amazing stuff that wasn't a Nazi.
Were they diehard Nazis, though, Richard, or...
See, that's what everybody keeps excusing these guys are. Of course they were.
Yeah.
Duh. What we did when we brought them over here is that we sanitized them. We, you know, there used to be the term in the intel community called sheep dipping.
Uh-huh.
We sheep dipped them all. If you read their actual dossiers, if you go back and you actually read, which I've been able to do, because I've had my own researchers in the National Archives, you know, extracting this paperwork for years, like Joseph has, as you'll see when we have him on toward the end of the show, you can actually read the U.S. Army intel guys who were, you know, doing the interviews and basically trying to see whether these guys were going to be threats to the United States if they brought them over here. And the unwhitewashed version of von Braun's dossier, where he was a major in the SS, et cetera, reads very differently, with the interrogator basically saying could be security risk, et cetera, than the sheep-dip version that we've all, you know, been privy to because of NASA propaganda for the last 50 years.
All right, so the Russians beat us. How did they beat us? Did they get the better Nazis?
You mean they beat us in the space?
In the space.
No, they didn't. And this is another mythology which we don't really get into in part one. This is going to be a three-part series, you know, von Braun's 50-year-old secret. Part one is already posted on Enterprise.
Right.
Part two, I literally finished 20 minutes ago. I sent it to Joseph to kind of read over because, you know, he has the background that is, you know,
sure,
their expertise in this. He's given me the green light, so sometime either during the show or at the very end, I'll post part two. Part three is going to be about some of the very strange politics that we've, again, been lied to. It is so obvious now that we let the Russians beat us. We could have beaten them. There are all kinds of examples of twists and turns of history and fate and all the other misimpressions we've been given. You know, history, as they keep saying, is written by the winners. Well, in this case, the winners are the ones who were in the White House, who were writing the history right after the so-called Sputnik surprise. We, the Eisenhower people, deliberately allowed Russia to beat us into space.
Because why?
Ah. Now, you want me to get into the politics of this first? Or you want to back into it later?
Give me a highlight of it, because
okay,
this fascinates me.
The reason was is that Eisenhower was pushing very strongly what he called his open skies proposal. He wanted, because we were very concerned about the development of nuclear weapons and you know, bombers and the beginnings of missiles in the Soviet Union, just like we were developing them here. That's why the paperclip guys were brought over to help the Army develop better versions of the V-2 so we could lob nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union and basically create what was called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. If they started a fight, we'd clobber them, and if we started the fight, they would clobber us.
No,
so
nobody
it was
wins.
Basically the Mexican standoff. You know, you got two guys standing in a pool of gasoline in a dark basement, and both have pistols, and if either one fires the shot, they both incinerate.
The Russians seem to have forgotten that in this latest incursion with Georgia.
Well, because it's a threshold thing.
Yeah.
They're only nibbling at their own borders. They're not threatening us directly, and we're not going to do anything. At least that's their
perception.
Their reasoning.
Yeah.
So we had this standoff, and Eisenhower, because we had nothing in those days. We had basically ground-based human intelligence. That was it. We didn't have airplanes. We didn't have satellites. We didn't have ways to look down. We didn't have real independent technical, what they call national technical means, to verify how many bombers, how many missile bases, how many missiles, et cetera, et cetera. We basically would count the missiles during the May Day parades in front of the Kremlin, which, of course, a lot of them were cardboard.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So there was this real effort on the part of Eisenhower, who was a general, remember, to get real intelligence. So he came up with this idea called open skies, where he basically put it up to Khrushchev, look, if you open your skies to reconnaissance, we'll open our skies, and that way both sides will know what each other's got, and we won't go to war over a misimpression or an accident or a mistake.
Interesting.
And the Russians turned him down. Soviets kept turning him down. What he didn't want, in hindsight, and the historians now are kind of freely admitting this, it hasn't leaked out into the general mythos yet. What he didn't want was for von Braun and the army guys to put up something called Project Orbiter, which had been begun as an idea in 1954. Remember, the Sputnik shock was in October 57.
Right.
In 54, they were discussing putting satellites into orbit. The Navy had some ideas. The Army had some ideas. The Army had von Braun, which was their ace in the hole. And he was very upset that he was turned down by McElroy, who was the Department of Defense Secretary, working under the White House, of course, under Eisenhower, and by Eisenhower himself, because the von Braun guys couldn't imagine why we would want to allow the Soviets to get ahead, and the Soviets had already published that they were going to launch a satellite. Now, the popular wisdom is that our guys didn't take them seriously. Oh, those stupid backwards commies, they couldn't, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
and we got stuck.
Wrong,
we got
wrong,
caught.
Wrong.
Not the case.
Again, more lies. What really was going on is that the White House deliberately would not let von Braun launch a military satellite over the Soviet Union, because what they wanted was a civilian satellite, either by the Navy, under the guise of Vanguard, a separate private, you know, research effort.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, worst case scenario, the Soviets would do it first, and then we would not object. And if we didn't object, then in the court of public opinion nationally, internationally, in the UN, et cetera, the open skies would certainly extend at least to satellite altitudes. And that would have given us the green light to fly over the Soviet Union territory with spy satellites that were on the drawing boards, Project Corona. The CIA was busily trying to put together a way to put spacecraft into orbit with with film cameras, and then they would literally re-enter the warhead or the spacecraft and pluck the film out of the water, develop it, and take a look at high-resolution images of bombers and missile bases and all that. Well, this whole open skies idea was to basically let the Russians go first so that we would then have the political excuse that they could no longer claim that space was verboten.
Knowing that we could go at just about any time we wanted.
Exactly. Now, that's a complete 180 from everything you've ever been told, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first time I've heard it.
NASA, never a straight answer. So, I mean, Mike and I wrote a book called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, where the mantra in the book is, the lie is different at every level. Remember, that was given to me by one of my best intel sources.
Now, did the Russians have a von Braun German counterpart that they got, the cream of the crop?
They didn't had a Russian guy.
Okay.
Korolev, Sergei Korolev, who was a genius, homegrown, who, of course, Stalin had thrown into the gulag. You know, Stalin threw all their best guys into the gulag, and those that survived and came out did incredibly amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
Like Kolyarov is one of them. Kozyrev, the guy who basically invented torsion field physics, is another, who spent, I know, 20, 30 years in the gulag because of Stalin. The Russians did not treat their own talent, their own geniuses, very well. And still, these guys came out and worked their hearts out. Korolev actually was the genius who built the Russian ICBM force and who said to Khrushchev, you know, we really could launch a satellite with this thing. And Khrushchev kind of said with his left finger, well, if it doesn't interfere with, you know, making sure the Americans don't get ahead of us in missiles,
right,
go ahead. He never had, nobody seemed to have a clue as to how the planet would go wild with whatever nation launched the first satellite into orbit, neither the Russians nor the Americans. And it was this little fencing game that Eisenhower was playing to be politically correct so that he could then put satellites over the Soviet Union, look down with cameras, and they couldn't politically do a damn thing. They also, by the way, couldn't blow them up. They did not have anti-satellite technology. So it was all about public posturing. It was all about how it would appear at the UN, the court of public opinion around the world. Propaganda was a lot more important in those days than apparently it is these days. I mean, look at how Russia, how Putin, seems to not give a damn about what the world thinks. He's just going to do what he's going to do.
He's going to do what he's going to do this time. That's true.
So that's the background to the shock on October 4th, 1957, late at night, during a party at the Russian embassy for a whole bunch of high-level space planners from the White House and the NRL and the Navy and the Army in Washington. They were having this little reception, and suddenly somebody runs in and said, the Russians have just put a satellite into orbit.
Uh-huh.
It's on Radio Moscow. And everybody, of course, cheers, and they raise their glasses, toast them, and that was the beginning of the space race.
They wanted that to
happen. They wanted that to happen. Now, if you want to really get high-level conspiratorial, of course, we would never go there.
Not
right?
Us.
No, not us.
Definitely not you.
What if there were some really bright guys around Eisenhower who realized that the big, fat, complacent Americans, if they did let von Braun put a satellite up, would stay big, fat, and complacent, and we would ultimately lose the bigger game, because if the Russians were second, there'd be no spur, no shock, no real, you know...
There's nothing like ketchup, right?
Exactly. And it was an incredible blow to our pride. And there's nothing like a blow to your pride to make you, you know, turn from Avis into Hertz. So I think that there was a combination of Eisenhower wanting to do the real politik, that is, get the Russians where he wanted them, which was a satellite over the U.S. territory that we would not object to, which would give him his carte blanche to do open skies and satellites, because the Russians had already turned down his proposal for aircraft like the U-2.
Which is what they got eventually. They got the carte blanche, didn't they?
Well, yeah, because when the Russians launched on a military ICBM, making it a military project, because there were no civilians in the Soviet
Union. Of course, we also launched on a military Redstone, didn't we?
That's right. The Jupiter C was a converted Redstone, but by then, remember, they'd gone first. And we didn't object. In fact, what did Eisenhower say at that first press conference? He dismissed Sputnik as that silly little bauble. and basically downplayed any strategic significance to the Russian feat at all.
Because what did Sputnik do once they launched it? It just made some beeps and
then... Well, it had a radio transmitter. It had no scientific instruments, as far as I can remember. It was basically a basketball-sized aluminized sphere with four antennas sticking out of it. It went around the world in little, I don't know, maybe 100 and some minutes. I forget what the orbit was right now. And what it did was it fell back to Earth within a couple, 3 weeks or a month, I think.
And it had no propulsion system to
it,
right?
Well, it was kind of, no.
It was just
launched
a ball.
By its own carrier rocket and then set free. But it was just a weightless object careening around the Earth, falling eternally around the Earth, which is what a satellite orbit is, where the Earth is basically curving out from underneath it so
right.
It never hits the ground again, until the atmospheric resistance, the friction up there, even at about a couple hundred miles, brought it back down.
And it burned up. That was it.
Exactly. Its total value was symbolic. And what it did was to make America, every American, from, you know, Harvard down to the lowliest janitor working some night shift, God knows where, think that we were second.
My father, who at that time was working for Ford Motor Company, came home, and he was, you know, the old country type parents, who, by the way, celebrated yesterday their 59th wedding anniversary.
Oh, my. Congratulations.
But, I mean, it was, you know, when he came home from work, he stayed home. They stayed with the family. Very rarely did everybody go out later. You know, you went out on weekends. And, you know, when he came home, took his shoes off. We all had dinner, and we stayed home as a family. I remember him coming home, and then when the news broke, maybe it was the next day, about Sputnik, he had this look on his face that I can't describe. He wasn't scientific by any means, but he was an American. You know, he was in World War II. And he had this look, Richard, of someone who had been beaten, defeated, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah, it was like a Packer fan watching Vince Lombardi lose.
Yeah, they just couldn't believe it.
It was inconceivable, and oh my God, these backward commies had shown. I mean, it was such a shock to our ego.
And then he's trying to explain to a 7-year-old kid what this was. And he didn't even know. Other than whatever happened, we don't have one. At least that's what his perception was. And
yeah, it was like we no longer had the right stuff in a time when we hadn't even coined that phrase.
Yeah. And the people, actually, Americans who were on top of this story, they were afraid.
Yes.
They didn't understand what this was. The Russians have gone into space. You know, they just didn't know. It was amazing. It was an amazing time.
Well, the more perspicacious realized that if the Russians could put a bauble into orbit going around and around the Earth, they could also lob nuclear weapons with those same rockets to hit any American city they wanted.
That's true.
And remember, I lived through duck and cover. You know, I heard constant reports about the bombers and the dew line and, you know, keeping a watch over the Arctic and, you know, invasion threats. And, I mean, it was an incredibly paranoid time. And for the Russians to suddenly upstage us, again, you know, every time someone says to me that I'm not following the dumbness model, that even people in positions of authority can be really dumb and stupid,
mm-hmm.
I say to them in counterpoint, look, if people in positions of authority were that dumb and stupid, then billions of people would be dead tonight because the world wouldn't keep running. When you know, to paraphrase Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when you see something happen in politics, it is not coincidence, it's by plan and design.
And you know we don't believe.
And now I know that this was by plan and design,
yep.
At the very least, because Eisenhower wanted open skies, and this was how he was going to get it. And at the worst-case scenario, somebody realized that if Americans took their licking and were second, for the first time in their modern history, it would galvanize, just like World War II, just like
Pearl Harbor. Yep.
Awoke as the Japanese, what was it, who was the admiral who planned the invasion?
For
who said, you know, we've just committed a terrible mistake because we've awakened a sleeping giant,
that's right.
Yeah.
We'll get him.
Huh?
We'll get his name.
I think it was Kozumoto or...
Well...
Somebody out there will Google you.
All I know is somebody played his part in Tora Tora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was absolutely right, because Americans are at their best when they're the underdog, when they have to fight back to become number one again. And if someone planned that, they planned it brilliantly, because not only did we out-achieve the Soviets in terms of spacecraft and science and exploring the solar system and all that, but without Sputnik, we would not have gone to the moon. And remember, the real prize was the ancient artifacts of an extraordinary civilization waiting to be found and brought home and looted by Apollo on the moon that no one was supposed to talk about publicly. And you couldn't get an Apollo unless you made the Americans afraid that they were going to be second rate to those darn commies.
So true. So true. We're coming up to the break. When we come back, we're going to get right into this launch. And was Von Braun, was he upset that the Russians, the Soviets beat us?
Oh, he was furious.
See, he didn't understand the big picture then, did he?
Well, he was, remember, he was part of this German contingent that were brought over, put to work, but not really trusted. He worked his way up in the army ranks, you know, with Medeiros and the Department of Defense. But he was not bosom buddies with Eisenhower. He was looked at as basically an enemy combatant who'd been brought over and put to work for the good guys.
Yamamoto,
yeah.
You got it. We'll be back.
See, we've got a great...
See, they're quick. They're quick. With our guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland. If you want to see the heading on the NighthawkZone.com, take a look at what they've done to Richard C. Hoagland and me, I guess, for that matter. Good artwork, by the way. They've got Richard on Mars. I'm not too far away. Back in a moment, as we talk now about this incredible anti-gravity, how much did we know? How much do we know? So, Richard C., Sputnik goes, and then we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sputnik goes October 4th, 57. Shock sets in. Suddenly, the fetters and the ties and the prohibitions and the actual memoranda and directives that had come down through the Pentagon prohibiting Von Braun and his team from accidentally launching a satellite earlier.
Accidentally?
I mean, there's literally, it's on the record. Just Google. You can Google all this stuff. This government forbid Von Braun and his team from accidentally launching a satellite. They literally, with their Jupiter C booster, if they had added a fourth solid-stage rocket, could have put something into orbit. You know, the joke was they could have put a beer can in orbit, and it would have been something in orbit before the Russians.
That's right.
They were specifically forbidden, under pain of Leavenworth, from doing that. They had to put sand in that fourth stage to simulate the weight for their ICBM warhead test, so they didn't accidentally launch something ahead of the Russians, because it was all about Eisenhower and his political open skies idea.
Jeez.
And maybe that other hidden agenda that we talked about in the last hour.
Yeah.
So Sputnik happens, and suddenly, you know, McElroy and the other guys all up and down the chain of command, including the White House, are to Von Braun, when can you get a satellite up? When can you get a satellite up? And he says, 90 days. Actually, he said, 90 days. And that's what they did. Now, the reason they were able to do that is because secretly...
They were ready.
They were ready. They had actually mothballed in what they called permanent room temperature storage, long-term lifetime test, a rocket, the upper stage solid rockets, all the hardware. So they just basically had to get it out of storage, dust it off, and assemble it and launch. And they did that in 84 days. So they weren't going from a standing start. They actually had everything ready based on the idea that the Navy would flop. Remember, in December, the Navy tried to launch Vanguard, and the thing rose a foot off the pad and then fell back with a crescendo of incredible pyrotechnics and explosions.
Yes.
And thermonuclear-type fireballs and right on live television. So that was not good for the propaganda war vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
It crumbled within itself.
It basically sat back down, and then it just folded up like an accordion full of fuel, and of course the fuel exploded. Oh, and the little satellite, the 6-inch test article, flopped away onto the beach was actually still beeping after going through all that, and it's hanging with its little antennas bent at weird angles in the Smithsonian. If you go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, you can actually see this chrome, silver-looking thing with burn marks on it hanging in the ceiling. That's the actual Sputnik satellite, which is what the world called it, that was a result of the December catastrophe of the first Vanguard launch attempt. Anyway, so in January, the night of January 31, von Braun gets his shot, gets his chance, and they are able on this Jupiter C launch vehicle, which is a modified intercontinental intermediate range ballistic missile, an IRBM, to launch the first U.S. satellite built by JPL called Explorer 1. JPL is the West Coast lab associated with Caltech, which will figure very prominently later in our story tonight.
And what kind of telemetry and data were they going to be able to get from it?
Well, Van Allen, who was a very high-level scientist of the period, worked at the University of Iowa, had been tapped by Stuhlinger, who was one of von Braun's key right-hand Germans, and they'd been talking with him for years. He actually furnished the equipment, and a guy named George Ludwig, who was his chief grad student, you know, grad student slave labor, actually designed the electronics for the radiation detectors that were going to go into Explorer. What's really eerie and makes me very suspicious is that Van Allen actually designed his radiation gear, which made him a household name, made him famous when Explorer 1 discovered the so-called Van Allen radiation belt in that first few orbits and then in the succeeding launches of Explorer 3 and Explorer 4. Van Allen actually designed that equipment so that it would fit either into the Vanguard satellite configuration, which was a sphere, or into the Explorer satellite configuration, which was a cylinder.
What's the significance of that?
Well, he was hedging his bets. He knew. He knew there was going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
And he was ready to launch on the second option, which was the Explorer, the Army, the von Braun option. Normally, scientists are not that broad spectrum. They're very narrow band. You know, when they design equipment, it's basically for one vehicle, for one purpose.
They don't have a backup.
They don't. Well, they may build more than one copy, but it isn't multi-purpose. And this was for one of the first times in U.S. space history, in fact, maybe the only time I can think of, it was designed to fly on either bird, whichever one would fly first, which was very perspicacious of Dr. Von
Say that was pretty smart.
Unless he was tipped. Unless he was part of the in crowd. And they basically told him, look, you know, James, whichever one goes, you'll be on it. So design it to fit both. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, all the way along the line, you find these little thingies that make you wonder about the official history. So von Braun, with his Jupiter C, which consisted of a first stage liquid fuel, basically a super kerosene and liquid oxygen, and an upper set of stages, 2, 3, and 4, which were solid rockets designed and built by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which had cut its eye teeth on solid rockets a la Jack Parsons on the West Coast in the 30s and 40s, they put this spacecraft into orbit that night. And as I describe in the paper, and I did this very deliberately, you know, we didn't have the worldwide tracking network then that we have now. So you basically launched your satellite down over the southeastern horizon of the Atlantic Ocean from Cape Canaveral, and then you crossed your fingers and you prayed.
Well, how did they know it made it into space?
They didn't.
They
literally had to wait for it to come all the way back around the entire world until it came over California, where they set up some special radio listening gear in the deserts just north of San Diego, a place called Earthquake Valley, which, of course, makes you sleep really well at night.
Yeah.
And they were waiting for the signal, and they had a phone line, a long-distance telephone line complete with an operator. Remember those?
Gosh.
Where you had to actually call an operator to place a long-distance call?
And then she patched you in.
She patched you in. Well, they had this line open between the guys in the radio shack You know, that's where the term came from. Radio Shack sitting in this Earthquake Valley desert in the middle of the night in Southern California, listening for a beep, 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 you know, when it came over the horizon.
That's
on the
amazing.
Pacific side. And a phone line to Washington where Von Braun and Van Allen and Bill Pickering, the head of JPL, and General Medeiros, who was the head of ABMA, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, which was technically the group that launched the first satellite, Army all the way, were waiting at the Pentagon for this telephone alert that would tell them from California, we got the signal. Now, look, the theory was that if it had made it all the way around the Earth to where it was flying over California, the damn thing was in orbit.
It was in orbit.
It was up. It was there. And it was supposed to be about 108-minute orbit. Well, they waited, and they waited, and they waited. And, you know, 1231, 1232, it was supposed to come over California about 1230 Eastern Time, Eastern Standard Time. 1233, 1234, nothing. There are pictures I have in this paper that were taken that night of Medeiros and Pickering and Von Braun, and they're priceless.
Oh, is that, that's the shots of them kind of like with phones in their ear and stuff?
Yes, with phones and their expressions. I mean, Von Braun looks like he had just learned that his mother had died.
Well, they didn't have computers then for mathematics.
They had very primitive computers, but they didn't have the radio tracking. There were no worldwide tracking network. You literally sent this thing around the world, and you had to wait for it to come back around.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like that old joke, you know, if you throw a baseball fast enough away from the Earth, it'll come back and hit you in the back of the head in billions of years. Well, you literally had to wait for this satellite, if it was a satellite, to make its way all around the Earth and to come back over the first piece of land that it was going to fly over where you had a radio station, which in this case was San Diego, to tell you that it was, in essence, in orbit.
So they were projecting when this would happen,
exactly.
So they were off by a little
bit. Well, remember, the Newtonian mechanics of satellites is really, really, really simple. You know, it's not the economy, stupid, it's Newton laws, which are really, really, really basic. Again, any kid, you know, high school kid can use these to figure out satellite orbits.
Unless there was another anomaly.
Well, unless there was a huge anomaly. So they have a rocket of known thrust, known fuels, known everything. They launched this sucker up from Cape Canaveral into the darkness of the southeast skies from Cape Canaveral. It disappears over the horizon. They get radio confirmation that they've got the firing of the first stage, and it drops away, and the second stage, and it drops away, and then the third stage, and the fourth stage, and it disappears, and they don't hear anything, and they don't have enough data to know whether it really was going fast enough, and more important, in the right direction, because the directional pointing of these early boosters was very primitive, to know whether it had actually made it into orbit. There were certain, you have to be firing your engines when you're parallel to the Earth's surface. Otherwise, you're wasting the energy going up or going down, and you don't go into orbit. You basically crash back into the Atlantic Ocean.
And they probably had no idea where it went.
They didn't. They had zero idea, and they're waiting. And the predicted time for the orbit that they wanted, which was 200 miles by 220 by 1,000, would have given them roughly 108-minute orbit at, by the way, 33.33 degrees to the equator.
How convenient.
That was kind of cute. And they were waiting on the phone for California to say, okay, we got it. And the time came and went when they were supposed to, if it was in orbit, get that call. And nothing happened. And nothing happened, nothing happened, nothing happened. And I have actual quotes from Von Braun's, you know, journal when he wrote for the Iowa Sunday Register a couple months later, the awful feeling that they'd blown it. You know, it hadn't gone into orbit, it had gone into the drink.
It right.
Nosedive into the South Atlantic. At 12:42, something like 12 minutes past its due date, the California stations suddenly get the signal, and they know they've got it in orbit, and everybody goes wild. They're all applauding. They're raced by cars from the Pentagon, where they were not supposed to have a press conference, because remember, Eisenhower didn't want this to look overtly military
right. Even
then. So they run them all over to the National Academy of Sciences, which is across the river and up, I think it's Independence Avenue, you know, up by the Capitol, up by the Smithsonian, up in northeast Washington, to have a press conference at 2 a.m. with absolutely a packed room of press from all over the world.
So, the media knew there was a launch, right?
The media knew. They had staked out the Cape. They weren't invited in those days. You know, they kind of were miles away waiting and looking, so they knew there had been a launch. They saw the thing light up the sky and dart up into the darkness on the Redstone first stage. But they didn't know anything until there was an official announcement. It was not like 24/7 news cycles now.
Right.
It was the dark ages. And most of them were print people. There were some radio guys there. There was maybe one or two television guys, but it was basically newspapers.
And it was film then, too.
And it was film. Film at 11.
Yep, that's
true. Except this was film at 2 a.m. So they run them over there. They have this press conference. And nobody, particularly Von Braun, says anything about the absolutely impossible, amazing, magical, it cannot have happened thing which had already happened, that all the inside guys had to have known happened, and no one was saying anything. Namely, that when this sucker was put into orbit that night, with a known rocket, with known thrust, known efficiencies, known fuels, known everything, its eventual orbit was one-third higher, George, than it possibly should have been. One-third higher. 600 extra miles appeared out of nowhere in the orbit of Explorer 1.
What happened?
Well, there's no way that could happen. Now, the excuse within the community was, oh, Bill Pickering's upper stage rockets had been more efficient than they were supposed to be, because these were solid fuel rockets and solid...
A little too strong for what they thought.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's amazing to me, and this is why when everybody's reading this, and of course, the website's getting hammered now because everybody's trying to get in to download this paper. By the way, do everybody a favor. Don't read it online. Get in, download it, and then get off so the next guys can get in. Because if you don't get off, I won't be able to upload.
Yeah, and it's a long article to read.
It's very long, yeah. And you're going to want to read it several times, because this is not, I'm not writing for kiddies here. I'm writing for the real crowd. And we'll get into that maybe in the next hour, some of the interesting feedback I've had. But the amazing, it simply should not have happened thing was this orbit was one-third bigger. One-third bigger, 600 miles bigger than they'd planned. Now, that is one hell of a bump to hide under the carpet.
Is that a mistake?
No. There's no way, because the fuels simply were not able of giving that bang for the buck. Remember, this rocket science is a science because you're always dealing with specific... I mean, the Newton's laws, as I said before, are 300 years old, minus, you know, a decade or two. It's not like this was born yesterday. The fuel, the solid stages were developed over 20 years by JPL. The solid fuel rockets, or the booster, had been developed from the V2 heritage. The Redstone was basically a souped-up V2. You know, that Von Braun spent 10 years from the deserts here in New Mexico at White Sands, going back to Huntsville in Alabama, and then the Jupiter C was a modified, souped-up version of that with extended tanks and what was called a Hydyne fuel, which was a higher-energy fuel. Everything was known, so to get a 30% increase in performance, I mean, it would be like in this day and age of $4.50 a gallon gas. You start out knowing that you're, you know, Tom is listening, right?
Tom is listening.
Yeah, Tom gets 17 miles to the gallon when he's not using these
right
things.
Right.
It would be suddenly if he was getting 28 miles to the gallon. And what? There was no possible reason why suddenly he should jump up with having done nothing to his engine from 17 to 28.
Well, who was the one who said there's something strange here?
Nobody.
Not even Von Braun?
Nobody said anything. That's what's so absolutely amazing and how I know that the lid of secrecy, the heavy hand of cover-up, the classification at the highest levels, obviously, of the White House, descended that same night. Now, none of the press guys asked any questions. Von Braun never volunteered that, you know. In fact, 2 months later, and I have this reproduced in the paper, the actual verbatim words he used in the Iowa, you know, Sunday Register piece were, we made a slight miscalculation in the orbital period. Slight! 30%! You don't make a 30% error in rocket science and do anything.
It wasn't, according to you, a miscalculation.
Well, it's not according to me. Again, these are equations I've had now, the actual rocket equation, plugging in all the numbers from the publicly available data on the Jupiter C, the rockets, the fuel they were using, the thrust levels, the number of pounds of fuel, the tonnage, everything is all there in this first paper. Nobody, and remember, I have a lot of critics. If I had made any mistakes along the line in calculating all of this, I would have been excoriated. You know, you would have heard 50,000 emails from people saying, oh, Hoagland's blown it again, that kind of thing. Nobody's been able to pick holes in the science because there are no holes to pick. This is an absolute miracle. 600 extra miles appeared in Explorer 1's orbit that night from nowhere, from literally out of magic land.
When we come back, Richard, tell us why.
So somewhere along the line, Richard C., they discovered, by accident, anti-gravity, some major effect?
Well, you start out with these basic celestial mechanics. You do something that 300-year-old Newton's laws say is really simple. It's thrust, it's weight, it's fuel, it's all knowns. You throw this thing into space that night, and it winds up in an orbit one-third bigger than it ever possibly could have. And the astonishing thing is that everybody in the press who's supposed to be covering this doesn't ask a damn question. None of the other science guys asked any questions. Even Van Allen's chief guy, Ludwig, who I quote extensively in this paper series, accepts the idea at face value. This is a physicist. Accepts the idea at face value that, oh, it had to be the rockets. Now, in defense of all these stupid people, I'm sorry.
I'm going to
pull my punches tonight and not tell you what I really think. In defense of all these people, remember, we're dealing with a physics that makes this impossible. By every mainstream thing, all of these bright geniuses thought they knew this was impossible, therefore it had to be the rockets. It had to be. There was no other explanation. Now, von Braun, and this is where things get really cool, von Braun, by his actions, completely vindicates what I'm going to tell you for the rest of this program. Because what he started doing secretly, clandestinely,
on his own,
obviously without a sanction by the White House, by the Army, by anybody, he started sending out correspondence, letters. Remember good old letters? This was before email. These are actual letters that we believe are in his files in the National Archive, if they haven't been sanitized. And obviously we are trying to get in there and get a view of the originals. The fortunate thing is that some of the correspondents with whom he corresponded all over the world have publicly acknowledged and published their side of the conversation. So we know this correspondence existed. Now, who was he corresponding with? He was corresponding with the coolest, neatest, most far-out physicists existing on the planet in this time frame, 58, 59, 60, et cetera, et cetera. And what was he talking to them about? Anti-gravity experiments, anti-gravity technology, anti-gravity theories of physics that would throw Einstein, relativity, and Newton, you know, three laws of gravitation, into the ash can, looking for a real physics which could explain the miracle that he knew had been accomplished that night that he was not telling anybody about publicly.
Now, this event was an accident.
No.
They didn't anticipate it.
Oh, yeah. It was
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Now, if it was a one-of-a-kind, you could say, okay, Hoagland, you know, they just had they were really lucky with that batch. You know, Bill Pickering just mixed up one hell of a batch of fuel.
And off it went.
But, of course, he didn't do the mixing. This was, you know, done by, I think it was Aerojet General that actually made the rockets. Point is, this was only the first of multiple instances of the same damn thing happening.
So each time you're saying they launched, they were up by 30%?
Von Braun launched. He had five satellites in the Explorer series that he was going to try to launch. He made 3 out of 5. He missed with 2. He missed with 5. He made it with 3 and 4. So 1, 3, and 4 were successful. 3 out of 5. That's not bad.
That's
back in those days.
In those days.
That was phenomenal.
Good. Yeah.
Because like 50% of the rockets, you know, that you sent up came back down without going anywhere, except boom. So now all of these Explorer launches, again, this is all on the web. The links are in the paper. Follow the links. Don't just read the paper. Follow the links. I spend a lot of time putting links in because that's the way you now reference. And the links go to primary sources, NASA, Smithsonian, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Marshall, which is the Marshall Space Flight Center, which von Braun was director of for you know, 30 years. The links are there for a reason. Follow the links, and you'll get to the primary source data. The two other satellites in the Explorer series, Explorer 3 and Explorer 4, also achieved incredibly anomalous orbits. And the first one is interesting because it was even slightly better than Explorer 1. But that's explained because the perigee was slightly under the 2,200 miles. I'm sorry, 220 miles.
Well, now explain this to me, though. Was there some kind of anti-gravity effect there?
Well, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do this very methodically so people can follow step by step. Don't want to leave any steps
out. Or did the rocket create it? So that's what you got to tell me.
No, absolutely not. The rocket did not create this. There's no way the burning, the fuels, the energy in the fuels, the nothing about the that part
could
of the process.
Could not do that. Okay.
Was in, you know, and this is why von Braun, remember, von Braun was on the cover of Time magazine. I got a picture of him in the first paper tonight, showing him on the cover of Time, listed as Mr. Missile Man. What is a rocket guy doing writing clandestinely to cutting-edge physicists all over the planet right after Explorer 1, asking about cool alternative physics that can explain his satellite's unbelievable orbit? The answer is there's no way to explain this except he knew instantly it was not normal. It was not his rocket. It was not his bird. It was nothing that he did or could have done. The numbers simply tell you.
Or was aware of.
Well, he was aware of it. He was not aware.
He wasn't aware of it prior to.
No. It was a surprise.
Right.
After the fact, it was like, holy, I can't say that.
Well, but if it continued to happen on the
it
other.
It kept happening,
other,
yeah.
Then didn't they have to factor that in on all the subsequent launches? Later on, Apollo and everything else?
Well, that would have been the worst-case nightmare. The scenario is that you can't launch anything and depend on Newton. And remember, they did not know how damaging or how this would propagate or under what conditions. So it was total unpredictability. This literally, if they hadn't figured it out, as I say in part one, would have been a showstopper to the entire U.S. space program.
Did the Russians have the same problem?
Eventually they did, and they figured it out, and they fixed it. Now, obviously, there was no communication between what the Russians were doing and what we were doing, what von Braun was doing. So they obviously figured it out separately. And in part two, I explain how they figured it out, and in part two, I explain everything about this, and that's why we're going to post that tonight after everybody gets to read part one.
Well, when you say fixed it, why didn't they use it as opposed to fix it?
Well, they did both. Remember, when I say fix it, if you launch, you know that old nursery rhyme, I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to earth, I know not where?
Yes.
That was their problem. They were going by Newtonian mechanics, and suddenly their predictions by this 300-plus-year-old database...
Out the window.
Were out the window. And, you know, I mean, this is... I'm trying to think of an everyday analogy. It's like if you go to your ATM and you think you got so much money in there and suddenly you find you've got 10 times more.
Or in my case, 10 times less.
10 times less. Well, but remember, this was they were fat. They were getting something for nothing and they didn't have no idea where the nothing was coming from, but they couldn't count on it. Because when they launched Explorer 4, they only got 1/6. Of the effect.
But are you saying that they discovered, by accident,
yep,
some kind of anti-gravity field or effect?
That's what it
out
like
there in space.
That's exactly what it looked like. Now, here's something really cool. Not only did the Army encounter this, von Braun's group, but when the Navy finally got their act together and they launched their 3 Vanguard satellites, 3 out of 11 that they planned.
Same thing happened?
The same thing happened.
And they didn't share that with them?
Well, we don't know. Yeah. Again, the Army and the Navy were not really talking to each other. There was this inter-service rivalry that we've heard so much about as a reason why Eisenhower eventually created NASA to try to bring peace to the family, to give a super agency that would kind of keep everybody in their proper place and would be civilian and open and above board and accountable to the American taxpayer. Yeah, sure. We'll get into that in a minute.
Well, and also tell me, why is this important? If they stumbled into this anti-gravity effect, why is that important?
Well, the first reason it's important is because if you can't predict it, you can't have a space program. Remember, if Eisenhower was going to have an open skies satellite look down on the Soviets,
right,
you have to put a spacecraft into a predictable orbit so that it's over a specific missile base at a specific time. You open the shutter, you take the picture, you re-enter it where you want, you're able to retrieve the film. If none of that was predictable, then open skies was out the window. Satellite reconnaissance was out the window. You couldn't send a spacecraft to the moon. Now, this, by the way, propagated into the efforts, the early efforts of the U.S. to have a moon race with the Russians and to win it. In 1959, toward the end of 58 into 59, Eisenhower created in the beginning of 58 something called ARPA in the Department of Defense, in the Pentagon, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And then a few months later, he signed the legislation that created NASA, and ARPA basically went behind the scenes and only worked on military stuff. But for a while, ARPA was controlling both the civilian guys in space and the military guys in space, although it was really all military. Are we confused yet?
Holding on.
Okay. So ARPA decided to basically up the ante, faced with urging from Bill Pickering, remember the director of JPL, who had built the Explorer satellite, who was von Braun's best bud for years and years and years. And he had proposed, Pickering had proposed back as early as 54, that they go to the moon. And again, he'd been turned down flat. Nobody wanted to do anything to upstage the Russians until I think the Russians did their thing and we all went, had conniption fits and kittens. So after Sputnik, he got a green light, Pickering did. And the ARPA people, the Advanced Research Project Agency in the Pentagon that Eisenhower had quickly formed in March of 58, within a couple months of the successful Explorer 1, they decided to create a moon program of unmanned launches running for the next year or two called the Pioneer Series. And they gave half the launches roughly to the Air Force and half to the Army.
Why were they split it up like that?
They were trying to keep the services all happy.
All right.
You know, inter-service rivalry. I mean, you were in the Navy.
Well, yeah, but it sounds like redundancy, doesn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, but remember, it's not their money.
True.
It's our money. So they were trying to keep peace in the family. And plus, you had this core of expertise. You know, you had the Army guys, you had the Navy guys, you know, who knew basically how to throw rockets into the sky. So you had to depend on those people to do what you wanted to do, even if you were, quote, doing it for science. So this was the first fledgling moon race with the Soviets. And we lost that one. The reason we lost that one is that von Braun, the Air Force simply blew it. Every rocket they put up blew up, flew sideways, did everything it was not supposed to do. They never got near the moon. When it became von Braun's turn, he basically used a souped-up version of his Jupiter C, called Juno 2, same configuration, except bigger tanks, that kind of thing. And he was able to launch a little, it was kind of like a typewriter-sized satellite, shaped like a cone.
And they thought he was a hero.
Well, he did the best of what he had. Anyway, the Soviets tried in, I think, the early fall of 58, with their Luna 1, and they missed. They missed the moon by 3,700 miles, and they weren't using any kind of technology.
3,700 or 1,000?
3,700 miles. 3,700 miles, they missed the moon.
That's kind of close, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but they missed.
Yeah.
And according to the specs that I have, again, linked directly to Soviet sources on the website, they should have been able to hit the moon within 60 miles, and the moon is 2,160 miles across, So 60 miles is the size of the crater Copernicus, you know, near the center of the moon when you look at the moon on a full moon night.
So they missed something.
They missed it by its own diameter and then some, another 1,000 miles. Not good. Now, von Braun launches a few weeks later, and his spacecraft misses the moon by 37,000 miles.
Okay. That's what I saw.
10 times the distance, the missed distance of the Russian.
How could he be so far off?
Exactly. So I'm looking at all this data, I'm pulling this all together, and I'm saying, okay, two problems are really here. Because, look, there's no way you can have an Apollo program. There's no way you can have a viable effort to beat the Russians with anything if you are missing the moon by, you know, 10, 15 times its own diameter. You can't do anything that has been visioned. Now we're into the Kennedy era, you know, 61. It was not until 1962 in April that, and again, I tell the story and the chronology and the events, that I think both von Braun and Pickering figured it out. They realized what had gone wrong with their early space efforts, and they were able to implement a fix that would allow them to predictably, this is the key thing, predictably put things into space where they wanted them, when they wanted them, and get them back. And obviously, if you couldn't do all that, you couldn't put human beings into space because you kill them.
By factoring in this anti-gravity effect?
Exactly.
Did they ultimately end up using this for spaceships?
We don't know. That's part of the hidden mystery. And the only way I've been able to approach this is through circumstantial physics. Remember, a lot of other people in the community that you talk to, including the UFO community, they are constantly depending on sources. They're depending upon this guy to leak something and that guy to leak something. Okay, we don't. We over here at Enterprise, except for a couple of people who've proven extremely reliable and whom we constantly check anyway with the physics, with hard data, with real science, we do not depend on sources. When I come on and I say so-and-so source told me, it's because I have additional confirmation from another mechanism, usually the physics, usually figuring it out in terms of the numbers, that backs up what our source or sources have told us. So we had to do this by the numbers, and the numbers say that around 62, April of 62, actually around my birthday of 62, April 25th, they figured it out. And from then on, they were able to successfully place spacecraft into precise orbits. They were able to literally hit the moon where they wanted to, when they wanted to, and that is when von Braun suddenly reversed a four-year position standing in the way of the implementation of the entire Apollo program, and that story is in the first part of the paper, and he reversed course and admitted to the idea of lunar orbit rendezvous, which made Apollo possible. Because remember, if you can't launch things into space reliably on predictable trajectories, you can't rendezvous. You can't bring two guys together in spacecraft. You can't send them down to the moon and bring them back up and have them get together. They'll die of starvation or lack of air in orbit. So everything was contingent on solving this celestial mechanics nightmare. Now, the flip side of this coin is that we haven't spoken yet, and we're going to actually drag our feet and not do it until the top of the hour, to what the upside of this whole thing was that magically, out of nowhere, 600 extra miles appeared not only in the Explorer program consistently, but in the Vanguard program. Do you know that the Vanguard satellites, those three little satellites and one bigger one, are in the highest orbits of any man-made object put into space at the dawn of the space age, and some estimates out are that they will last 2,000 years.
You mean they're still up there?
They're still up there. The three Vanguard satellites, which were, by the way, if you go and you look at the literature, the Navy guys were worried that they could barely make orbit for 2 weeks. When they made their orbits, they also went consistently much higher than they should have. In fact, their orbits are so much higher that they're up out of the air resistance to where they literally could be up there for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. We could all disappear, George, in 2012 or whenever, a global nuclear war if Putin has his way, and the next wave of civilization could look up and still see those satellites orbiting around the Earth as leftovers from that previous epoch and those dumb idiot guys that blew themselves to kingdom come.
Of course, is there a secret space program? We'll talk with Richard C. about that. Joseph Farrell joins us. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Richard C. Hoagland, now joined with Joseph Farrell, who had an early interest in physics, mathematics, and even music. Until his days in college, he had an accelerated mathematics program where he then became interested in ancient texts, and he has a Ph.D. He is the author of the Giza Death Star Trilogy, Reich of the Black Sun, and the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Here he is on Coast to Coast, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Joseph, how are you?
Pretty good, George. What a show tonight.
Oh, my gosh. And there's Richard. There you go, Richard. There you go.
Things will really heat up now that Joseph has joined us.
Oh, yes. And, Richard, you wanted Joseph here for a specific reason. Tell me why.
Well, Joseph is probably the expert on the planet on the beginnings, the entree point, the way to ferret out the real truth on the secret space program. What is so eerie, I mean, I have to thank Tim Ventura for introducing us to each other. I mean, he did me one hell of a favor when he basically said one day, there's this guy, Joseph Farrell, that wants to talk to you. Do you want to talk to him? And I mean, I talk to anybody. So I said, sure. And it was the greatest thing that's happened to me in the last couple of years, because Joseph is, A, exquisitely professional when it comes to research. He knows how to dig. He knows how to ask the right questions. He knows how to cross-correlate. He's not confused. He doesn't depend on sources. He goes to documents, evidence, things you can taste, touch, smell, feel, and count on. And it's amazing how his research, from a completely independent perspective, I mean, we hadn't really talked to each other up until about a couple of years ago, has totally tallied on this Nazi, what do they know and when do they know it stuff, and the foundations of the real secret space program, and this latest set of insights into von Braun and what he found out, and then how he was muzzled, again, fits perfectly into Joseph's independent assessment.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I have to second your statement at the start of the show that this probably is one of the most important coast-to-coast shows that you've ever done because, again, I think our research has been dovetailing in ways that neither of us could have even coordinated had we had a mind to.
And there's a third guy who's not in the conversation but is here with us tonight, and that's Jim Mars.
Oh, yes.
Who was just on with me last week.
Exactly, and we both listened, and it's eerie how Jim has put the political pieces on the table in play.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's scary when you think that we basically won the battle of World War II, and we may have lost the war because the Nazis have cleaned our clock, and they're the hidden hand behind so much of this that we can now document and prove and will stand up in the light of day.
Well, you know, after witnessing Richard and Joe, these UFOs that I saw several weeks ago with these night vision goggles, now I'm convinced that there's a very high likelihood of a bigger secret space program.
Yep. Now, by the way, let me correct something I said earlier in the first hour.
Mm-hmm.
Rama didn't see the boomerang with the glasses. She saw it with her naked eye.
Ah.
They all did.
Okay.
And, you know, because I wasn't there, I was Sasha sitting, and I was minding the store here, so I didn't get to go down and have fun. But, yeah, this thing was floating silently over the city of Albuquerque, broad as you know, whatever you want to call it, and illuminated by the lights of the city shining up, and they saw it with their naked eye.
All right. Now let's get into it. Plus, I want to talk with you, Richard, about NASA, you too, Joseph, what we're doing on Mars and if this program is truly giving us the information we want or if they're holding that back. But let's take a little step backward, Joseph, for a moment and pick up where Richard was talking to us about their discovery here. Why is it important that in this discovery of anti-gravity, this kind of effect,
Did this lead into a secret space program, or were they headed in that direction anyway?
Oh, I definitely think it leads into a secret space program. I was on Coast last year talking about my book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell.
Right.
And I've got two more books in press right now with two different publishers that continue this story. So it's a story that really kind of goes on and on once you get into it. But basically, what I came to the conclusion was, in my examination of the Nazi secret weapons projects, is that we already see the glimmers back in the Third Reich of a two-track space program being set up. On the one hand, you have von Braun and his rocket team with the V-2s and V-1s and so on. And that's kind of the public secret space program because obviously it had a very visible effect. You've got V-2s raining down on London and Paris and
exactly.
Everything else. So, you know, people were definitely aware that the Nazis had pressed this technology beyond anybody else at the time. But then with the Bell, you have very specifically, in my opinion, a project that deals directly with hyperdimensional physics, with anti-gravity, with so-called zero-point energy, and so on and so forth. And the key to this project is that there is some very peculiar personnel overlap, at least the key in terms of what we're discussing tonight. For example, one of von Braun's team members at Peenemünde was a fellow by the name of Dr. Kurt Davis. I have a picture of him in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell with von Braun. Davis was actually not a rocket engineer at all. He was an electrical engineer. And he's the fellow that built the power plant for this Nazi anti-gravity device called the Bell. And he was also a member, therefore, of the Bell's research team. So he's one of these indicators, and the significant thing about him, George, is that he ends up as a flight director for NASA during the Apollo moonshot program. He's right
Joseph, he's more than that. He is made the center director of the entire Cape Kennedy launch complex for the entire U.S. civilian space program.
Right. So this is a very significant Nazi.
And speaking of Nazi, tell them how much a Nazi Kurt Davis was.
Well, he was a real Nazi. The reason we know about him is because he actually denounced, and in fact, one of the reasons we know even about the Bell Project is that we have documents that he denounced a fellow co-worker in the Bell Project to the Gestapo. And this is all in his file. It's part of his paperclip file, you know. So he was, you know, he was definitely part of the team, so to speak, back there in the Third Reich. He was certainly not one of these people that joined the Nazi Party just because that's what everybody else was doing.
Or they were forced to.
Right, exactly. So, you know, this man achieves a very senior position within NASA, as Richard has indicated, and yet he's also one of these very few scientists that we bring over here and make part of our public space program that definitely had his hands in a project that was dealing with some of this hyperdimensional anti-gravitation physics. So we know that for a fact. But there's yet another Nazi that I've recently discovered through some research that my friend Igor Witkowski over in Poland has shared with me, that he's publishing in a German edition of his book, The Truth About the Wunderwaffe. And that is that one of the medical people that worked on the medical aspects of the Bell Project, how to limit the effects of the field that it gave off on living plants, animals, and presumably
sure.
human beings. One of these people was Dr. Hubertus Strughold. Now, anybody who does research in NASA will soon find out that Strughold was one of these, you know, barbarous people that performed some of these grisly medical experiments in Nazi Germany.
He was like Mengele without the rep.
Yeah, exactly.
Gosh.
Good way of putting it. But he comes over here and basically kind of pioneers our space medicine effort.
He
so,
becomes
you know,
head of the space medicine branch
right.
of the, I think, Brooks Air Force Base in Texas.
Right. So, you know, here we have another Bell scientist that has a prominent position within NASA after the war.
I guess better us than the Soviets at the time.
Well, yeah, you know, this is the other part of the puzzle. And, you know, I've one of these books that I've got at press now I try and make the case that the Nazis kept this anti-gravity technology to themselves after the war as part of a very complex strategic evacuation plan that actually had been cooked up by Martin Bormann. So, you know,
jeez.
Yeah, you know, this story just never ends.
It's a story, George, that keeps on giving.
Yeah,
because
it really
the way
does.
It keeps giving is every time you open a new door or turn up a new document, you find these cross linkages.
Yes.
You find these double agendas.
Yes.
You know, it's like the Nazis we brought over here to work for us, we wound up working for them.
Yeah.
And they had an agenda, a long-term agenda, which I frankly think, based on my own work, on Joseph's work, on Jim Marr's work, is now coming to fruition.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it in the form of these vehicles that are bold as brass and are flying over major American cities and over George Bush's Western White House in Texas, the so-called Stevensville incident. I think it was one of ours, except it's not ours. It's this mysterious third force that Joseph and Jim and I have now started calling the Nazi International, that is a continuity of the guys we thought we buried 60 years ago.
Could belong to this so-called New World Order, right?
Yeah, well, that's what the New World Order is.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, let's call a Nazi a Nazi.
So, Joseph, you are convinced, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that they have anti-gravity propulsion.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, one of the things that Richard makes clear in these papers, and he's been kind enough to share part two with me before he's posted it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he makes very, very clear, and you really have to sit down and read through these papers very carefully, is that the physics of conventionally explaining what happened to Explorer 1 simply does not work. It has to be something else other than the rockets, and he fingers it very, very precisely. And it's amazing to me because, once again, we've kind of backed into each other in our research because, you know, we're like two guys with
independent confirmation.
Yeah, in a darkened room with
blood of science.
Yeah. With flashlights, you know, and we keep bumping into each other because I found the same thing not only in this wartime Bell project, but I have been able to document similar physics being researched by the Nazis after the war. So, you know, it again, over and over and over again, you find the same physics conceptions, and I have to agree wholeheartedly with Richard here. It's not just the sources you have to pay attention to, but when the sources give clues to the physics, that's really what tells you the story. You kind of have to piece this together very, very carefully, bit by bit. But I come to the same conclusion, coming from a very different point of view, that Richard has, and that is sometime during this period that he's talking about in the Von Braun papers, there's something else going on covertly behind the scenes, both inside and outside of NASA, and it's being run by a bunch of these Nazis. So,
when you start looking at the NASA program that came into play after the early satellite launches,
right?
And again, we're not talking about just one, we're talking about three Navy satellites, the Vanguards, and three Explorers. So we got a total of six of these early satellites until they figured out what they were doing, quote, wrong, and then it really goes black. It really becomes sub rosa.
Why the need for the secrecy?
Well, this is all they wrote, George. This is the keys to owning the Earth.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
If you have, and let me foreshadow what is in part two. Because it turns out that not only did von Braun inadvertently trip over anti-gravity that night with his Explorer launch, what he really did was to trip over free energy,
yes,
a way to technologically pull energy out of another dimension,
yes,
and stuff it into these spacecraft so that it would wind up in much bigger orbits. And the orbits are the fossil evidence of free energy on a humongous scale.
Yes.
And what I'm going to lay out in part three of the series, remember, part two is written and I'm going to post it after the show tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Part three is going to be how this can be done by anybody in your own garage. You can do this. And the absolutely incredible practical effect it will have on your everyday life. And believe me, that's a third part worth waiting for, because it doesn't have to do with rockets and rocket science and weird Nazis. It has to do with bread and butter economics and the reason we don't have to pay for $4.50 a gallon gas.
Are we talking about zero point?
Well, that's one of the names. Yeah. What's in a name? Shakespeare. We're talking about energy from another dimension that can be put to use in this dimension, and that's what they were really covering up. Anti-gravity is kind of one closet in a whole mansion of things they don't want us to know about, because if we knew about it and could use it, we would no longer be under their control.
That's right.
It's all about control.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me second that for a minute, George, with some information about what I've uncovered in this recent book. I just sent it off, as a matter of fact, a couple days ago to the publisher. That's how new this is. But I ran into a similar thing, and you mentioned yourself, George, the idea of a third force. Well, it's interesting that whenever you find the post-war Nazis active in the world politically after the war, you will find dictators that they're propping up or sponsoring, such as Juan Perón or Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You will find them talking very openly about this third position between capitalism and communism. And dig long enough, and you will find a bunch of Nazis hovering behind the scenes. Now, interestingly enough, in one of these post-war Nazi research projects investigating precisely the physics that Richard is talking about, you inadvertently find all of a sudden it's made public, and then every attempt is made to discredit the project openly in public, and it goes deeply black once again.
Right.
And scratch and sniff long enough around that project, and you find a bunch of Nazis hovering in the background.
Now, the original paperclip Nazis, are they all dead?
No.
So there's still some that are out there.
I mean, I've had some, shall we say, nibbles from people that represent them. I had one particularly interesting nibble from a very responsible scientist who was chief of a laboratory at a major university that had access to these German Nazis, and he actually dangled that in front of me.
They got to be 80, 90 years old
by
now.
They're in their 80s and 90s, and I have not heard peep one from this individual. He contacted me after he heard me teasing the von Braun paper and this program a couple weeks ago on the show. And I think it was, I've had several of these, how should we say, feelers from people who offered to review the papers before we published so they could, quote, capture any mistakes. And these obviously are plants of people that wanted to know, have a heads up in what we had figured out so they could communicate with the guys behind the scene who've been trying to stuff their fingers in the dikes and keep this covered up for 50 years, because it's blatantly obvious once you look at it. And, you know, remember, Joseph is not a member of the choir. He and I have some really interesting toe-to-toe arguments where we do not agree on certain things.
Right.
So I used him as a sounding board. I said, find the holes in this. Tell me where I've gone wrong. Tell me where I haven't backed up what I've backed up.
And let me add something to that, too, George. When Richard says that he's been contacted by some of these people, I've experienced very similar things. So, you know, it's not something that is peculiar.
It's not isolated to him.
No, it's not. And, you know, it's very, very strange when you start delving into this. And I think the key for both of us is that we've figured out that there is a Nazi angle that is active and in play in this stuff. And that's probably, you know, it's frightening to contemplate that. But I think that's probably the concern politically for why these contacts are being made.
Well, this brings us back to Jim Marr's book, which could not have been more perfectly timed.
Right on.
More perfectly timed.
Right.
Well, hopefully he's listening to that, or his ears are burning.
Well, and I was going to say, for you here, Joseph, because we've heard Richard on this, but if NASA's listening tonight, and I'm sure they are they cringing right now?
Well, yes. I think they are. Because, again, you can't read this paper and come away, particularly once you get into part two, you can't come away with any other impression than that this stuff is experimentally validated. So, you know, this is the big problem. And, you know, the means of validating it are so incredibly simple that, you know, it almost boggles the imagination. But it points to the existence of a technology. And if that technology exists that can experimentally verify this with such simple means, then certainly in 60 years they've had time to do a whole lot more with it.
Joseph and Richard, let's go to Mars when we come back. On deck, Richard Hoagland, Joseph Farrell. Richard, you've got an email or so from some folks that you wanted to read to us.
Yeah, as I was saying, one of the reasons for putting up this paper series is to try to smoke some of the old-timers, the old guys that worked with Von Braun, the early space program, with Vanguard, with the early parts of NASA, the honest people out of the water so they remember things. They connect. They go back in their own history and say, oh, my God, I didn't. And they kind of put those dots together. This is what happened with Ken Johnston when we met. A lot of stuff that he saw going on at NASA in terms of hiding things and being ordered to destroy photographs of the artifacts on the moon and all that, he did not remember until he'd read Monuments and we'd had conversations and he went back over his own life. In fact, he's actually doing his own book now on many other things that he has remembered. But at the time, there was just too much going on and he wasn't really paying that much attention. All these professionals were so busy, busy, busy in this incredibly hectic historic period when we were desperately trying to outgun the Russians from this position to number two. You know, you don't work any harder than if you're number two and you thought you were number one. The psychology was perfect, but it made all these people kind of ignore and just cast a blind eye to the weirdness that was going on.
Yeah.
That they just kind of rationalized. So I'm trying to get these folks to remember. And we hit real pay dirt with this email, which I've shared with Joseph, which came in through a very trusted source. I've known this source now for 20-some years. This is a friend not only of the source, but it turns out that I've known this individual separately for about the same period of time. So I know absolutely that this is 100% for real.
Okay.
It says, I've just now finished the read, meaning of part one, even though it's a long one. Funny, but I had forgotten completely the trigger that went off in my brain as we watched the world hold its breath waiting for word over San Diego. He's talking about Explorer 1.
Right, right.
I didn't fall for the solid rocket high SP fluke story for a minute. As we were mixing solid propellants for Mighty Mouse at SUSE, those are code words, at the time. At that time, I didn't care about orbital mechanics and errors. Quote, I push, you steer the canoe was our motto, for Von Braun's team anyway, and never did. Even Dr. Rydell, the VW mechanic, that's another individual. But I do remember visiting our NAA navigation and orbital mechanics guys one afternoon and discovering they were working on some new top-secret recalculations of celestial mechanics for Apollo, just as they had completed all the initial work. Boy, were they pissed. This message could be a book of my own, but it's late, and I'm just to the point of offering one itsy bit for Hoagland to consider. He covered the U.S. Army, the Navy, the USSR situations very well, interweaving the dots with hard factual documentation, and all the dates fit perfectly as I remember them. But, and there is always one but, he ignored the physics leak of Allais' discovery by Von Braun to his countrymen in S.A., that's South America, George, guests of the Rocky Plantation, and Joseph will explain what that means in a minute. That's why he, meaning Von Braun, never talked about it, even until his death, as Hoagie puts it. My congratulations to Hoagland on an excellent investigative report, signed blank.
What's the Rocky Plantation, Joe?
Okay, George. In the new book that I finished up, it's called The Nazi International, and I talk about a research project that the Nazis were conducting in and close to San Carlos de Bariloche, which is in Rio Negro province. It's about 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires. But more interestingly, if you get into the documentation, what you'll discover is that all sorts of Nazis went to this province of Argentina. They bought more than 10,000 square miles, which is about the size of the state of Massachusetts, for themselves. So in other words, they made it kind of a post-war Nazi Vatican. And there's even allegations that Martin Bormann was present in the area after the war in that particular area. But if you look at the pictures of this area, it's very remote, it's very rocky, it's very mountainous. And, you know, there's just so much here. But one of the things that really stuck out at me was this research project was ostensibly being conducted by the Peron government. But I suspect when it became public, due to a precipitous announcement by Peron, that the secret Nazi masters of this project deliberately discredited it in the eyes of the world press, and it went deeply black once again. So in other words, I think that this email is definitely authentic because of this allusion to this particular area of Argentina with that rocky plantation. And the plantation itself is a very significant clue, because if you get into the literature, if you dig into what's going on down there in Argentina, this Nazi enclave was called Estancia, in other words, a big ranch, a big plantation. So in other words, you know, the reference to me is extremely direct.
And again, I know this guy. I know the source, and I know the guy, the engineer who wrote to him, and I actually have his email, and I'm going to, you know, I've asked him some questions, but I have to be very careful because I obviously don't want to get him into trouble. And I asked him, George, to come on the show, and yeah, he said he actually didn't want to do that for his health.
Of course, we know what happened to Ken Johnson when he tried to come on.
Well, yeah.
Remember that?
And remember, we're dealing now with probably two orders of magnitude more serious stuff here. Remember, once you have demonstrated that orbits are not Newtonian,
yep,
or Einsteinian,
yep,
that celestial mechanics does not work the way those old theories have told us, you know, they've worked for hundreds of years, that have been the Bible of mainstream science, then all bets are off. What this demonstrated to those that had eyes to see, and it's still up there. As I said, these things are still cruising around the Earth in orbits that won't come down for thousands of years. What it proves to anybody that knows anything about rocket science is that something bizarre went on that cannot be explained by any physics that we think we know, opening the door to all the physics that we don't know.
So you don't think, though, Joseph and Richard, that whatever they picked up was based on reverse-engineered alien technology?
No.
That's another scam story.
I don't.
It's another red herring.
The reason I don't, George, is many people have tried to convince me that the Nazi Bell project was, in fact, based on recovered reverse engineered craft.
Right. And Mars writes about that,
yeah.
Jim Mars.
But the problem is that when you try and trace down these stories of Nazi crash and retrieval efforts, there's just really no documentation. It's not even on the same scale at all as a Roswell or a Keksberg incident. So, no, at least in the case of the Nazis, I'd have to give a firm no to that.
All right. Now, Richard and Joseph, let's talk about Mars for a little bit. We're almost at the top of the hour in 15 minutes. Anything new there, Richard? Are you happy with what the Phoenix lander is doing?
He's a Pope Catholic. Anything new there? Good grief. You know better than to ask me that.
God, that's the way I prompt you.
With an hour and 50 minutes left in the show?
Yeah.
Guys. Yeah, we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. I had a call last night from, again, one of these very reliable intel sources. Remember, I was told weeks ago that there had been a secret briefing of the White House and of the Obama and the McCain campaigns,
right,
on the discovery by NASA of life on Mars. And then my old friend Greg Cavalt, who's a senior editor now with Aviation Week, published a story a couple weeks ago. And then NASA quickly rushed out another press conference claiming that, oh, that's not what we were going to talk about. This is what we're going to talk about. You know, misdirection, misdirection. Never a straight answer, NASA. Well, this source called me last night, had been on a mission somewhere, I have no idea where, except his butt ached a lot because he'd been sitting for 20 hours in some airplane with a whole bunch of other guys in uniforms, and he reaffirmed that that initial briefing did take place. Now, let's flash forward. Suddenly, remember how candidate Obama was very negative about NASA in the beginning of the campaign?
And he changed his tone.
He was going to raid NASA for money for education. He was going to basically put the Bush plan to go back to the moon and onto Mars on hold for 5 years. Well, I would like to claim credit by means of my white paper, which is on Enterprise, which we know was personally delivered to him and to McCain and to Hillary and to Bill, because Robin actually gave it to Hillary and Bill here in Albuquerque when they came during the primary season. I'd love to claim credit that our paper is the thing that convinced him to turn 180 degrees on space, on NASA, but I don't think that's what happened. I think it was that he was given information which is so mind-blowing that will be obviously first on the docket of his administration if he is elected this fall, and that's why he's now suddenly coming out four square or billions of dollars more for NASA, closing the gap between the retirement of the shuttle and the new spacecraft, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is an absolute 180-degree about-face from his previous position, obviously based on him getting new information. Space is really important. Now, I told the Libertarians when I spoke at their convention a couple, 3 months ago, that NASA was going to, before the election, announce life on Mars. I still think we're on track that they're going to announce that there are at least microbes in the soil. So what happened the other day, George? We had Chandra Wickramasinghe, the friend and colleague of Sir Fred Hoyle, who came out. He's a physicist with Cardiff University in Britain. He's one of the major astrobiologists on the planet.
He's investigating this red rain.
He investigated the Kerala red rain. We don't have a definitive report there, by the way, which would be interesting if Linda could kind of press the pedal to the metal and find out what's going on there. Chandra Wickramasinghe came out the other day, published in the BBC, that NASA is hiding current life on Mars. Now, you know, for someone who's been out here in the wilderness all these years basically saying, folks, they're lying to you, they don't tell you the truth, to have someone of Chandra's stature who worked with Sir Fred Hoyle, who really should have gotten a Nobel Prize for his work on nuclear astrophysics years ago, decades ago, to have Chandra come out and basically say, A, it's there, and B, they're hiding it, that's pretty damn cool. So we've got these separate independent lines of evidence. You know, Covault, my intel source, the data itself. You know, we've got soil on Mars where you can grow asparagus. Remember that?
I remember that.
So it's only a matter of time. Now, what's going to happen after that shoe falls? Well, all hell is going to break loose. That is going to be the final straw that brings this entire camel crashing down. Mixing our metaphors, Natalie, because all the things they've been covering up, once you open the door to life, any kind of life, just the teeny tiniest little bit of life, you've opened the door to the potential for bigger life and crinoids and fossils and, oh my God, Martians, which brings us back to Nazis. Joseph?
Well, you know, this is the whole thing with the Nazis. You know, von Braun wrote his Mars Project book back in the 50s and 60s. But there's this obsession with Mars itself in the ancient literature and ancient texts. And, George, I'm convinced that part of the Nazi impetus for exploring this alternative physics was precisely their conviction that, number one, you know, they, as Aryans, were descended from a celestial race that came to this earth and moved into Europe from the north. And I'm also convinced that they conceived or at least dedicated a part of their thinking about space missions to the recovery of some of these ideas, you know. And when I read Dark Mission, I was sort of floored, you know, that this was more or less the same conclusion that Richard had come to in examining all the evidence, you know, and kind of reverse engineering the history of the project. So, again, we're bumping into each other as we're both shining our flashlights in this very dark room, you know.
I mean, our conclusion in Dark Mission, Mike's and mine, Mike Barra, my esteemed co-author that you spent an entire weekend with, would probably tell you all kinds of interesting things about me, which are not true.
About the singing? Whoa, wait a minute.
Well, that was one thing that was true. Our conclusion was that NASA and the Nazis in NASA have hidden all this stuff because, wait for it, they believe they're the Martians.
Yeah.
They want to go home. That's why von Braun was writing all those books about Mars. That's why he was fascinated, enthralled, stupefied by the discovery of his own satellite that he had tripped over some extraordinary physics that would give him an independent means of getting to Mars.
Well, if they listen to Bob Zubrin, they'll terraform it, and off he goes.
Well, it already was terraformed. Yeah. They're just waiting to turn the lights on. There's all kinds of stuff there. Don't you get it, George? There is an incredible planet of ruins left by someone that these guys, the Nazis, feel that they are the only appropriate sole rightful heirs apparent to, and we don't count. And what they did is they crafted a set of secret programs so they can go back, they can get access, and to hell with the rest of us.
Yeah, and let me add something to that, George. It's been one of my convictions for many years that if you're going to pull off a project like what Richard is describing, and very similarly to what I believe actually happened, you would use the security compartmentalization of your host country against them to cloak your activities, because you still maintain a network of contact between each other, and certainly these Nazis had it. In fact, one of the early paperclip documents that examines the Germans, specifically with reference to von Braun and Dornberger, complains of the fact that even after their capture and internment by the Americans prior to their coming to this country, there still seemed to be an existing chain of command in place among them. So in other words, we have to open up the possibility, and I do this in the new book, that this post-war Nazi network was very well organized and did manage to stay in contact with each other. And I think probably what happened in this country is they simply infiltrated our own black projects and secretly coordinated among them.
Amazing stuff. Do you believe, Richard C., someone continues to write about vegetation on Mars? Is it there?
Depending upon which Thursday you ask me, yes or no.
Really? You change your mind on that?
No. It depends on how big a microbe is vegetation.
Well, I'm talking of, they're talking about trees.
Well, I don't know about the trees part, but I think there may be some kind of ground growth or algae or whatever. Remember that photo that was taken by ESA, the Europeans, the Mars Express photograph,
where
Linda was able to get one of the top project guys to basically say, well, it's green, it looks like algae, and the next day the photograph was changed and all became brown.
It was gone, yeah.
Look, the Nazis are everywhere. And, why has it become a kind of a throwaway line to talk about Nazis? They become the, Saturday Night Live buffoons of comedy. These mass killers who have done more systematically to destroy human life and the human future than any other group in history, the communists notwithstanding. Because when you look through the eyes of Jim Mars and his documentation, it turns out that these guys also set up the Soviet Union. They set up the communists. They set up the whole, Iron Curtain, et cetera, et cetera. They played both ends against the middle and took us all for suckers, and they're still doing it. And the higher-level purpose, I believe, based on the data, they have been trying to get home. It's kind of like E.T., phone home. They've been trying to get home. And this, of course, is the reason for von Braun's extraordinary obsession through his entire life and career. And I think the thing that killed him is when he realized toward the end of his life in the 70s, after we'd achieved Apollo, that he was not in the in crowd and would never be allowed to go home.
What did you think of his remarks to his aide, Carol Rosen? And
that's going to be in part three. And I needed to put part one and two up. And, of course, part two will be posted later tonight. And people also need to read
Dark Days. But he believed in a false flag.
He believed there would be a false flag alien intervention scare scenario. Now, the only way that von Braun could have known that was at two levels. Either he was directly told that this was on the plan, this was on the agenda, and I don't think that he was high enough in whatever hierarchy there was to actually be privy to that kind of information.
You might be right.
In fact, tonight I had a flash of insight, and I shared it with Joseph before he went on the air. I think Kurt Debus was basically sent with him as part of Paperclip to be his minder. Yep. Since he was a highly visible leader of one of the black projects that became white, i.e. the V2s, and they knew that he would be adopted into the American, military system, and Debus was attached to him like a leech to make sure that he didn't give away whatever he might have known about the really good stuff, the anti-gravity stuff. And then, of course, he tripped over it as part of his own open military satellite program.
When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Richard C. Hoagland and Joseph Farrell. about space.
Richard, you first. Dark Mission, is it still available to people?
It certainly is. It's climbing again on Amazon. It was breaking 600-700 earlier in the week, and probably it'll go to 2 or 3 tonight. It's still a New York Times bestseller. You never lose that once you got it.
That's right.
And it's the background everybody needs to know to understand the significance of what we're talking about. You know, if you don't understand how you've been lied to by the space agency, which was taken over by Nazis, brought over to help the Americans, who actually, as I keep saying, ate us for lunch, you're never going to understand why they're not telling you the truth on all kinds of critical things that will make the difference between your future being real and your future being dismal. I mean, I've been hearing your promos on After Dark, and it's obvious that this is our problem, and we've got to get it out in the light and expose it. And Dark Mission does that.
Very good. And Joseph Farrell, your latest work, where can we get it?
There's two books. One is called The Philosopher's Stone, and that will be coming out next spring with Farrell House, and then the Nazi International will be out with Adventures Unlimited. And then, of course, SS Brotherhood of the Bell is already out, and they can call Adventures Unlimited at 1-800-718-4514 or just go to Amazon.com or their local Borders or Barnes & Noble.
Okay, we're going to take your phone calls. Also, we're going to go back to Richard Z. Hoagland in a moment and talk a little bit more about the secret space program. Let's pick it up by going to Marilyn in Thousand Oaks, California. You're west of the Rockies. Hey, Marilyn.
Hi, George. Just a quick question for you gentlemen. When Nixon was president and he had all those Germans in his administration like Kissinger and Haldeman and Ehrlichman, were they part of the international One World Nazi cartel? And if they were, did they have a hand in taking him down for some reason?
That's a hell of a good question.
Yes, it is.
Who wants that? You, Joseph, or you, Richard?
No, yeah. Let Joseph handle it.
Okay, Joseph.
Well, in my opinion, and I don't talk about that in any of my books, but just based on research that I have conducted, at the very minimum, you would find Kissinger in that crowd somehow. Because if I'm not mistaken, Kissinger was one of the people that was involved precisely in the vetting of some of these paperclip scientists. So there is a connection there, although it's a very tenuous one. As far as Haldeman and Ehrlichman goes, again, there are some very interesting books out there. One is by Linda Hunt about the connections between the elements in the Republican Party that have supported people from Nixon on that do definitely have ties to these post-war Nazi organizations. So, yes, there is a connection.
And Kissinger was born in Germany, wasn't he?
Yes, I think so.
1923.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, made his way over to this country. So,
See, one of the key books, and we're plugging books tonight because without books you don't have anything. You got to get and read Jim Marr's book.
Yeah.
Now, Jim owes me a really big fee, which I'm never going to get, because I recommend his book to everybody. Without understanding the last 60 years, how we've been sold down the river, how the people who set up us in World War II actually set up the Nazis and the communists and played everybody against each other so they could make off like bandits, kind of reminds you of what has gone on in Iraq, doesn't it, with all the extraordinary billions and billions of no-bid contracts that have been let. Ultimately, it's all about money and control and power. And George, you keep asking the key question: how many cars can you drive? How many houses can you live in? Et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
At what point does enough become enough? For this mindset, enough is never enough, ever.
By the way, Kissinger was Jewish, and his family left Nazi Germany. They escaped.
Yep.
So, there you have that. Next up, let's go to our first time caller line, Gordon in Paterson, New Jersey. Hey, Gordon.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're great, thanks.
Science and magic constantly cross paths. Have your speakers run into that same kind of issue? Because we always see in the Indiana Jones movies that same science and magic crossing paths again.
Well, in Dark Mission, Vera and I lay out these three groups, these secret society groups that, again, George, in your promos, you keep saying it's the secret societies that will be the downfall of us all.
That's right.
We lay out the Nazis, the Masons, and the Magicians. And the Magicians, based out of JPL, Bill Pickering's shop, the people that built Explorer 1, who figured out how to solve the problem for von Braun, as I demonstrate in part one of the paper, we document in Dark Mission exquisitely with umpteen examples and paper trails and all that, the role of Jack Parsons, who some say the JPL is named after. Jack Parsons Lab is actually supposed to be the flip term for his name. He was a magician. He was a Crowleyite. He was a follower of Aleister Crowley. He thought that he could conjure up some strange entity that would usher in a new eon, a new age. And he was one of the key founders of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which has launched and landed and flown spacecraft by planets, according to all these magical and ritual, hyperdimensional, and celestial alignment dates. So you put it together. Again, without reading the book, the papers will be less revealing. And if you read the book, what we say now in this series on von Braun will become crystal clear.
Yeah, and I'd only second that. In almost all of my books, there is some sort of connection that I mentioned to esotericism and to occult studies. And certainly that's the case with these two books that I have at press right now. So I'd have to second that wholeheartedly.
And, Richard, do you want to address again that email that you got, wrap that up?
Yeah, let me pop this up here. We got an email earlier. Actually, I guess it came into you. At 11:33, I don't know whether that was at the beginning of the show. This is from Aaron. He says, what's the importance of all this?
Yes.
So it went into a different orbit. Back then, it was easier to miscalculate things since they haven't done it yet. So I don't know what the significance of all this is. Can you tell us what it's supposed to mean? I've been listening, but I'm lost. Well, A, that's a kind of a chauvinistic perspective, because back then is only 50 years ago. These laws that we're talking about are hundreds of years old. Newton's laws. Calculations were done by slide rule as opposed to computer. You know, we computed things to 20, 30 decimal places even back then. It isn't a matter of miscalculating. It was a matter of energy appeared in these orbits that literally came from nowhere, like a third more.
Right.
It'd be like you and I, George, we're going to take a road trip, and we decide we're going to drive nonstop from New York to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to St. Louis, and we look down at our gas gauge, and we find that we actually can go nonstop. For some reason, we don't have to stop for gas all across the country. Can't happen.
That's right.
But it did, and that's the big, extraordinary surprise. And how it was done is answered in Part 2, which will be posted tonight. And for all those people that don't have computers who listen to Coast, George will be very gracious, and he will invite me back on in a few days, and I will summarize for those people who don't have computers what's in Part 2.
Next up, let's go to Larry in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Larry.
Yes, I had a couple questions. First, I wanted to thank you for getting me on tonight.
Sure, of course.
The first time, and I was trying many times trying to get on. First, I wanted to know that I hear a lot of hearsays, not only a lot of lying through the government, but first I was understanding that we never went to the moon. That was pretty much a cover-up as to letting the world know that we were first to get there, but that never happened. That was fake. Second off, as far as the electronic field, was that done with some sort of, as you flip a magnet over, you know how you get that propulsion to push backwards, to push up, and whether or not that had anything to, as far as the propulsion, as far as flying, is what they're learning. And third, I was wondering if they learned a lot of this technology that we're getting today from, as you well know, the Roswell incident, where instead of talking about the craft or the aliens, that we got our technology, computer technology, and how we form our spacecraft, and how perhaps the Germans learned how to float through this technology that we learned from that craft.
Okay, let's get into some of these. First, you, Richard, you and I both believe we went to the moon.
We went to the moon.
Definitely.
The lie that we never went to the moon was started in my presence at JPL in 1969 on the afternoon of July 22nd, 1969, with me as a witness by NASA, designed to get all the people in this audience, George, who might ask questions, to ask the wrong questions.
Yep.
You believe that, Joe?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I definitely think we went to the moon. I think some of the data that the hoaxers point out is not necessarily indicative that we didn't go, but it's rather indicative of a different physics. And, again, that's the whole point that Richard's been making with these papers.
Yeah, the bottom line is that what von Braun learned in this extraordinary 10-year period from 58 to 68 when we sent Apollo 8 into lunar orbit, I think wound up in Apollo. That Apollo actually, and I've never said this before, and I will say it tonight, I think Apollo incorporated some very interesting anti-gravity technology.
So do I.
In Apollo, a direct benefit of what von Braun learned over those preceding 10 years, and that without that technology, Apollo would not have worked. He couldn't have made it work with the rocket technology that he was trying to put together. And that's the disconnect. That's where people who are honest but confused don't realize that there's a missing set of puzzle pieces.
Right.
And that's why this series on von Braun and his discovery of serendipitous anti-gravity, the way that space works different than Newton and Einstein have said it does, is so critical to understanding our own real history, including that of the Apollo program.
Yeah, I have to second that wholeheartedly, George. In SS Brotherhood of the Bell, in fact, I do suggest that there was some sort of alternative technology in play in Apollo. So, again, I think we're dealing with the same physics and the same pieces of the puzzle.
But we have evidence.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. Let's go to Northridge, California. Jason, take it away. Go ahead, Jason.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you? Thank you for doing the show.
Sure.
I had a simple question. I was wondering if you were aware of a researcher that I felt could provide a lot of corroboration to what you guys are pursuing, much the same way both of you are corroborating each other's research tonight. There's a man on the radio, on a public radio station, unnamed, in the middle of the night, of course. His name is Dave Emery, E-M-O-R-Y. And he seems to know an overwhelming amount of information about what you and Jim Mars are talking about, the Third and Fourth Reich, and with great specificity. And he talks about the Bormann Group and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I can't vouch for the guy's information, but I felt it would be valuable to put that name in the pot tonight. And
okay, do you have a website link or an email? Or
yeah, spitfirelist.com.
Spitfire list. Okay, can you send me a note to Enterprise? Enterprisemission.com. At the top, there's an Enterprise Mission public email. Send me a note, and I'll take a look.
Okay, very good. Next up, let's go to Robert in Tucson, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi, Mr. Ellery. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been trying to get on for a long time. What I would like to present to you guys that this technology of reverse gravity technology, believe this or not, was once declassified. And if you give me a moment, from 1957 to 1963, the United States Army of Fort Bliss, Texas, presented a science presentation where I went to high school in Chicago called Lane Technical High School. And the presentation was signed from three personnel from Lane from Fort Bliss, Texas to Lane Technical High School, three military personnel. And we were told at the military level this was classified information, but they said that the Army would make this a good presentation to the high school level, the high school students, and they did a presentation. They did 50 students a year, two classes a day, one day out of the year. They drew these 50 students out of 1,300 students of the freshman student body of Lane Tech High School. And this happened, like I said, from 1957 to 1963. I watched the presentation February the 15th, 1960. The presentation took place on the second floor within the far southwestern corner room of Lane Tech High School that used to be the old janitorial supply room. They would take the janitorial supplies, put them out in the hallway, and do this presentation on reverse gravity technology. Mr. Norrie, this technology was once declassified. Now, the presentation, when it was done, was on radar. They showed two presentations on radar. One was regular radio that was used during World War II, and a second kind of radar that was being developed and released into general aviation at that time called microwave electromagnetic Doppler radar. Then they showed us that microwave electromagnetic Doppler radar had a second side to it. By adding a few basic simple components to a microwave electromagnetic Doppler radar unit, they could produce a reverse gravitational field by reversing and compressing gravity, opening a vortex hole in gravity space-time, and producing levitation and transportation.
My gosh. Richard, this sounds pretty elaborate.
Well, it does. Does he have papers? Does he have access to documents? Did he say that?
When I came home from school, Mr. Hoagland, that day I took the papers that I had in that class and I gave them to my mom. I never had any more papers on that. I never saw those papers again until August of 2003, shortly after my mom passed away, and I found those papers. When I first sat down and read them, I couldn't understand what I was reading. But in October of 2004, I was on the Internet one day over at the public library, and I pulled down a website titled gravitywarpdrive.com, but done by a man named Kenneth Wright out of California. And what I was reading in that website, I said, hey, wait a minute, I got something at home. It reads basically the same technology.
Maybe he was in your school, huh?
Can you make copies? Can you make copies and send them to me and Joseph?
Yes.
Okay. How would I do that?
Our address is on the Enterprise website.
Right.
EnterpriseMission.com.
Well, I can't send them by internet.
No. But you can get his address off.
The address is there. You can send me a hard copy, Xerox.
Okay. All right.
We'll do that. And Richard, you follow up with that and let us know if you get them.
I sure will. See, we actually know there were something like 200 open corporate and government anti-gravity programs in the 1950s, including one division of the G.L. Martin Company, which made Vanguard.
Well, I know for a fact that Boeing was working on one 10 years ago when I was in St. Louis, and they had taken over McDonnell Douglas.
They all went black except for a few outliers that for some reason were still in public domain. About 1965, when the Air Force held a major conference in North Carolina, and then all of these, I mean, we're talking like John Lear's dad was involved, and as I said, the Glenn Martin Company, which built Viking and built the Vanguard rockets, and many other companies. There was a Gravity Research Foundation that used to give out awards to various people for doing interesting research, except they didn't give an award to certain people who should have had awards. Like, they never gave Maurice Allais an award for his astonishing discoveries in Paris in 1954 and in 1959, and von Braun was one of the guys to contact him. And there's a whole story about that, which is in part one of this paper. Again, if you're really serious about this, if you want to understand how this really impacts both the space program and our everyday lives, just stay tuned for part three, because the rubber meets the road in ways you would not imagine. It's all ultimately about free energy available, in essence, in your garage, if you know exactly what to do. And it isn't expensive, and that's the big secret that they want to keep secret.
I can't imagine. We're almost done with this program. This is a fast one, Richard. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard C. Hoagland, Joe Farrow. Richard and Joseph, take just a few minutes before we take final calls. I want you to kind of give us a synopsis of where you're coming from. You first, Joseph.
Well, basically, George, I'm coming at it from a slightly different approach than Richard. He's working his way back in history to the conclusion that the Nazis are very significant to this story, and I'm starting from the Third Reich itself and working my way forward, and we're kind of meeting in the middle. But basically, my conclusion has always been, and since I wrote SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that you do indeed find the glimmer of this two-track space program right there in the Third Reich, with the rockets being kind of the public version, and then the Bell itself and some other projects the Nazis were involved with, investigating this alternative physics. And, you know, Richard said it many times on your program, The key to it is rotation, 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 and certainly that's what you have with the bell. And there's one additional thing that I think I need to add to this story, and that is that I'm convinced now, having just finished the research for these two books at the publisher, that there is indeed, one of your callers called a Bormann Brotherhood, there is a post-war Nazi international. And I think to a certain extent, based on the research I just finished, that this Nazi international decided that they were going to enter this world of high international finance capitalism themselves and be a major competitor to the American elites that set them up in the first place. And Bormann, for your listeners who don't know it, he is really a financial wheeler-dealer. He's a financial genius, and he's able to put together something like this, and that's what I think happened.
All right, Richard C.
Well, you asked a question before about Carol Rosen and von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, if you're a physicist and von Braun's degree was in physics, and he was taught all the mainstream stuff, Newton, Einstein, relativity, gravity can't be contravened, orbits are orbits, etc. When he came up with absolute flat-out evidence that all that he'd been taught
right.
was wrong,
right.
flat wrong, his actions tell us everything. He reached out to these other cutting-edge physicists all over the world. We got the correspondence from their admissions. There's even a reference on the Marshall Space Flight NASA website in 1999 during an effort to kind of reinvent one of the experiments that von Braun got very intrigued with, this Maurice Allais in France, which is described in part one. And that is the documentation that he actually had this correspondence with Allais. We also have Allais' end of the conversation, which confirms that von Braun was in touch with him and actually helped foster the publication of Allais' amazing research in a Bible of the American aerospace community at that time called Aerospace Engineering in 1959. So we know that von Braun knew that nothing in his real world that he thought was real could explain what he was seeing in the Explorer launches, the Vanguard launches, and there are others that I haven't had time to get into. What did he do with all this? Well, ultimately, he told Carol that they, whoever they are, were going to go through this escalating series of things to keep us imprisoned mentally, including terrorism, and that the final card would be alien invasion, and it would be a false flag scenario. Well, the only way that that holds true, George, is if he knew there was a way to turn the physics that he got hit over the head with
mm-hmm.
into a technology which
right.
could fake alien spacecraft. Because remember, for most people on this planet, including policymakers, military, whatever, gravity is immutable. You can't control it. If something showed up tomorrow, like an Independence Day, and hovered over Washington, the immediate reaction of everybody would be, oh, my God, it's aliens. They're here. Nobody would think, oh, my God, it's the Nazis. They've come back.
Yeah, and let me just kind of put that into context, George. My conclusion has been that the Nazis pursued this physics research independently after the war. So if von Braun is letting something out to Dr. Rosen that he did in that affidavit, then I think maybe we have to look to that ultimate source as being the origin point for this whole agenda.
Good point. Let's go back to the phones. First-time caller Alan in Jacksonville. You are on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Alan.
How are you doing today, George?
Good.
My question is actually about a secret organization known as the Illuminati.
Yes.
The involvement between the Clintons, that would be Hillary and George, and Bush and Bush Sr., and possible involvements between Barack Obama and John McCain. Do you have any thoughts on that?
We got another 3 hours, George? That's the whole program in itself.
Well, let me field that one. I can tell you that the Skull and Bones connection, which is often talked about President Bush and Senator Kerry and so on and so forth and other famous figures in American political history, is true. But what most people don't realize is that Skull and Bones is a lodge chapter of a mother lodge. No one knows exactly what it is, but that it is located in Germany. And I find that very interesting.
Really?
Oh, yes, because if you dig into the history of some of these high-ranking Nazis, even a hard-nosed, ultra-materialist financial genius skeptic about all of these things, like Martin Bormann was himself a member of one of these little secret societies in pre-war Nazi Germany. And moreover, this is really what kind of sent me for a loop. Bormann bought a house for himself in Ingolstadt, Germany, which was precisely the place that the Illuminati were founded. So, you know, you get all of these very strange connections, and the story just goes on and on.
Chris in Canada, it's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Hi. I was just I was talking to your screener, and after I talked to him, I was just saying, you know, thanks for letting me on, and.
Well, that's fine. How about a question?
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say that, but my question for Richard C. Hoagland would be, what would a young person or anyone wanting to get into science? What would his suggestion be for studies, or what would his suggestion be in general for someone?
Would this be you're coming from the high school level into college, or are you already in college?
I've graduated from high school, and I've tried college, and I'm wondering what his suggestions are for pursuing science.
All right. Well, and what's your love of science? So, what particular area that would help him?
Nature and
like biology,
nature and astronomy.
All right, Richard.
Well, if you don't want to go to sit in a classroom, there are online courses up to and including PhD level, like Swinburne University out of Australia. I just recommended to a friend of mine the last couple of days, has some excellent online courses that you might investigate, and you can do them online at home.
And they're very good, too,
They're excellent.
Yeah.
Swinburne is excellent. The Internet makes it so doable to research anything you want. It's our global library. It's our global newsphere, to quote Norman Mailer. Now, you won't get credit for it, but if you simply want to learn, all the tools are there in instantly, electronically, with your computer. Now, if you want to actually get a job doing something,
you need the credit for it.
You absolutely need some kind of accredited courses, so you have to look at that. And in the areas that you're interested in, you know, naturalist, ecology, environment, these are incredibly important and will become more so in the next decade or two as people learn more and more what we've been doing to the Earth. You need to background yourself in both the standard material and realize that not everything is in textbooks, as we've been discussing tonight. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of material that's being taught which is flat wrong. And the art form and the problem for all this coming generation, George, is going to be to figure out how to walk the minefield and get the accreditation without falling into the mind control that's reality, because it's not. Reality has been manipulated, and we have got to open the system education-wise, to where we actually start teaching the real stuff.
All right, good. Thank you for the advice, Richard. Joe in Florida, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, that previous caller about the high school experiments and all that, I worked for a company in the late 60s called Norelco in Long Island City in New York.
Did they make that tape recorder?
Yes.
Yeah, they did.
The one that I used in the planetarium?
Exactly.
That
yeah, I was service I was the service manager for
I love that thing.
Yeah,
it was the first old cassette tape recorder that was basically nonlinear programming.
They also made shavers.
They made
that's
well.
Right.
I was
that's
too
exactly
young to use a shaver.
Right. Yeah, I was the service manager for their recorder products, but somebody leased some space for us, and we used to see military, high-ranking military people coming and going all the time, and nobody knew what was going on. When they vacated the area, they asked me to go in and see if we could use that area for one of our service shops. And when we went in there, it was painted completely black, some kind of flat black paint. And there were white marks on the wall, like graduation marks going up to the ceiling.
Huh.
And many times in the previous months, we were getting some sort of interference on our calibration equipment, and we didn't know what was going on. When I saw that, and they had two 440-volt lines in there, we had no need for that kind of power. But that paint, we couldn't cover it. It was so difficult to paint over. And it was RF dead. It was like being in a screen room. And, you know, my a couple of my technicians and I went in there and looked. And I said, you know, these people must have been working on, like, electromagnetic levitation. And now when that caller called in, I said, my God, they were working on anti-gravity.
Sounds like unbelievable. Or something of very unusual nature.
Yeah, I mean, we had a hell of a time trying to cover that paint. And I discovered that it was RF dead in that room. You could go in there with a radio, close the door, and you got nothing.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of weird.
Well, you're going to love part two then.
Hey, Joseph, do you believe anything has been engineered, reverse engineered from alien technology? Richard doesn't.
Well, I certainly hold open the possibility, but the problem is every time I look into the claims for it, I end up seeing more terrestrial connections to technology than anything that necessarily comes from outer space. This is particularly the case with the technology that's described in the Magic 12 documents regarding Roswell. Because, again, you know, if you look just at what the documents say, not what the Roswell story says, you're dealing with a technology for which there are very, very clear Nazi antecedents. So I have yet to be persuaded of the case.
Remember the guy you had on, George? I think he's a doctor from Houston, and he does these hospice visits for people who are dying.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he admitted to you on the show that one of his patients had been a witness to Roswell, had walked the debris fields and all that, and had seen swastikas in the debris on some of the instrumentation or whatever. Well, and then we have the stories that Von Braun and some of the paperclip guys were brought in as consultants.
Yeah.
Why in the world, and Joseph frames this very elegantly in his books devoted to this subject, which are, by the way, listed in part two of the paper, actually have the covers of his two books, The SS Brotherhood and The Reich of the Black Sun. Why would you bring in basically prisoners of war who you don't really trust to back-engineer alien ET technology,
right. The
most cutting-edge, super top-secret stuff that you've just had fall out of the sky, unless maybe it wasn't alien, it was in fact something that they would know something about because it was German.
Yeah, it looked familiar to them, and that's why I think they brought in the paperclip scientists, if, again, you credit these documents as being genuine. But the internal evidence, you know, of the documents themselves, George, again, suggests, and I go through these documents painstakingly and very slowly, to point out that the technology described is not exotic enough to be ET or alien. So at least as far as the documents are concerned, I think that the Roswell story, there's still some cover-up, and it's at a very, very deep level.
Okay, let's go to Bakersfield, California. David, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, David.
Hi, George, and your two gentlemen guests tonight. This is a great show. I'm a first-time caller and a long-time listener.
Thanks.
I just want to know of your guests, what do you think the general scientific community's response is going to be once they start reading this stuff? Do you think you're going to be laughed off the scientific block, or how do you think they're going to react?
You mean, is that addressed? Oh, it's probably addressed to me because I'm writing the papers. I'm hoping that we're at a point where data actually will take precedence over name-calling. Because these orbits, if you start looking at the history, I mean, as I said, I've had nobody write to me in the last week and a half since part one has been posted who's basically been able to poke a hole in anything. The numbers, the rocket equations, the orbits, the celestial mechanics is all there. And then you have Von Braun's own action.
Right.
That's
right.
Crucial.
It is.
Von Braun is our best witness, even though he's no longer with us. He is an incredible first-class witness because his own actions say he was blown away, did not understand what was going on. And if he didn't, with the thing he built, the Jupiter C rocket, then obviously, as Sherlock Holmes says, when you reach the end of the possible, you have to go for the impossible.
Right.
He reached out to alternative physics, and we, in part two, lay out exactly the alternative physics that he found that helped him and Pickering figure it out, that let Apollo succeed, that probably wound up putting anti-gravity in Apollo to make it succeed, and we're going to have a tremendous amount of fun. So what's going to be the reaction? Probably a big, deafening silence publicly, and a furious looking at all this privately, and then some courageous soul, like Chandra Wickrama Singh, will have the courage to stand up and say, the emperor has no clothes.
Right.
With these big oil companies out there continuing to squeeze, Joseph, do you really think we'll tap into these secrets of the unified
field? I do. There's only so long that physics can proceed on the basis of theory functioning as a kind of a religious dogma. And, you know, this is the problem I have with so much of this stuff, is that the data is denounced in favor of a reigning standard theory. And science is supposed to be about data and prediction. And the fact of the matter is what Richard is really trying to say in these papers, is that the Newtonian predictions simply did not come true. And therefore, there is another physics in play, and you have to look at the data in order to be able to understand the laws of that physics.
Joseph, thank you for being on the show, and Richard, thanks for assembling this one for us.
Thanks, George, for being a heck of a host.
All right, you take care. Joseph Farrell, Richard Hoagland, Richard's website, enterprisemission.com, Joseph's GizaDeathStar.com. Both of those websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, so we make it really user-friendly for you to be able to tap into it. Taking a day off, Ian Punnett will be sitting in for me Friday into Saturday morning. So make sure you're part of the program. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.